I'm going to call the order of the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. And first of all, I'd like to have my co-chair, Representative Witt, talk to us about a moment of silence here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to be talking later today about homeland security issues. And unfortunately, we receive word this morning that our ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens, and several of his staff were assassinated by terrorists this morning. Make no mistake, Mr. Chairman, this was planned in coordination with the 10th anniversary of one of the most solemn occasions in America's history, and another attack by terrorists on America. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would request a moment of silence in memory of our ambassadorial staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I'm going to open the informational hearing for the House Interim Committee of Veterans Affairs. We're going to start out today with Diana McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner, and she's going to update us on the Association of Oregon Counties Veteran Task Force, which I have been fortunate enough to participate in to a certain extent so far. So we just started.
That's right.
Commissioner?
Thank you very much. Good morning, chairs and committee members. I am Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McKeel. I'm also the mother of an active duty Marine and have worked hard to make veteran services a focus for my office, my county, and my involvement in the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here this morning to briefly speak with you about the Veteran Services Subcommittee that we recently formed through AOC. I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of your agenda today and for your support through the involvement of Representative Esquivel, as he spoke, who attended our first meeting, our first and only meeting so far, and the other subcommittee members from this body. As I said, last week, the Veteran Service Subcommittee had our first meeting, and we intend to meet monthly at least through next spring. The group was formed to bring a collective voice for counties on veterans issues and better enable local communities from across the state to take advantage of opportunities to support our veterans and get more engaged in advocacy for this important issue. Veterans are honored members of our community and should be treated as such. However, there are looming budget cuts to services at the same time that we have growing numbers of veterans who need them. We must get ahead of this issue to ensure that we honor our veterans. Part of that plan must include continued support for organizations doing the work in our communities that veterans live in, that can meet veterans where they are at and help put the veteran and his or her family in a position to be successful. The AOC Veterans Services Subcommittee members bring a valuable range of perspectives and expertise. The full roster is available for your review, and you can easily see the wealth of knowledge and expertise that is present among our committee members. As stated earlier, the subcommittee held its first meeting last week and identified some goals to work toward in the short term and the long term. I'll just briefly give you some of the goals that will include strongly advocate to maintain county and state veteran service officers during the largest demand that the VA has had in decades. Service officers in Oregon helped to procure $1.15 billion last year from the VA directly to the pockets of veterans, which go to the communities in which they live. We need to help our veterans access all of the benefits they are eligible for and do so in an educated and timely manner. We will focus on ways to help veterans access education and jobs. We will make sure that necessary health care services are available and recognize that it is better for the health of the veteran to provide services early. This includes mental health, alcohol and drug treatment, physical health, and other supportive services. Identify major gaps in services and investigate best practices and the agencies or stakeholders to address them. We will advocate to maintain funding for stand-down events and identify ways to leverage additional support from the civilian population for veterans in a consistent manner. We will begin development of a training model throughout the state that could replicate services and expertise across counties. We'll establish legislative priorities for the upcoming session and identify what would be priorities for the longer term. This is a short briefing to introduce you to our new subcommittee, and we look forward to continuing collaboration with this committee in the future, and thank you so much for your time today. Thank you.
Any questions?
Statements? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close that informational hearing on that. Open up one for the Nonprofit Assistance Veterans in Northwest Oregon. Jim Tierney, is that correct? Am I correct on that?
Yes. I brought some staff.
Must be Barb Wood and Grace Clark.
Correct.
Close?
Yes.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. I'm gonna be pretty brief because
for the record, would you state your name,
sorry,
please?
Thank you. I'm Jim Tierney, Executive Director of Community Action Team. Community Action Team is a nonprofit community action agency, one of 17 in the state. We serve the three counties in Northwest Oregon: Clatsop, Tillamook, and Columbia. I brought with me Grace and Barb because they're going to be much more intimate and be more informative to you than I would be by myself. But I want to just give a brief on how this fits in with community action. Community action programs are, in the rural places in particular, are gap-filling entities that look around their communities to see what things are not, what needs are not being met, and trying to find a way to deliver that. In this particular case, our primary program is the ODVA a veterans program that seeks benefits, as the commissioner just told you about. Grace is our VSO that does that work. And what happens is ODVA gives some funds to Columbia County, and Columbia County adds a little bit of cash from their budget and gives it to us, and we administer the program. So we're filling a gap that that has a need in the community that right now is not, does not break even. So we also bring some of our own resources to make, provide enough time for Grace to do as much job as she can. One of the ways that we work is we will look at a program like this, which is in the red momentarily, and try and match it with other programs. We'll look, well, what could we do that would give us some efficiencies that would allow this program to move into the black? And examples of that that Barb will talk about are the jobs program, where we have some volunteers that are working with us, and SSVF grant that we just received that serves Clatsop, Tillamook, Columbia, and Washington County, which Barb will talk about. With that, I really just want to introduce the program. I'm going to ask Grace to talk about the things that she does, and then Barb will talk about the SSVF and the jobs program and the general thing. Grace's role, as I said, is our veteran service officer. Barb is the director of our human investment program, which is the side of community action team that really provides services to individuals.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. As he said, I'm Grace Clark. I'm a relatively new veteran service officer. I'm a veteran myself, so I am able to, I think, bring something to the table when meeting with veterans. And veterans in general in this era of being able to get online and find out anything that they may want to do can apply for benefits online. However, the advantage of meeting with a veteran service officer is a face-to-face meeting and being able to sort through the specific and unique needs of that veteran. My role is to provide legal representation for that veteran on behalf of Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to prepare a case for the veteran in the form of a claim, to present that claim on behalf of the veteran, and possibly to enter into prosecution if there is an appeal for the veteran. I'm bound as a veteran service officer to have a contracted power of attorney with a veteran. I'm bound to comply with the code of standards and code of ethics under Title 38, as you know. And that involves a lot of confidentiality, Privacy Act information in discussion with the veteran. Basically, as a veteran service officer, we're learning about the very intimate details of their lives, past, present, and trying to provide the best possible benefits for them for their future. When it comes to the impact on this in the community, I know that it has been proven that the return on the investment that comes back to the community on a veteran receiving benefits is huge. One thing that I'd like to stress is the beauty of the Veterans Service Office being co-located with Community Action Team in Columbia County. That offers a synergy to be able to offer veterans more than just basic veterans benefits. I have some examples that I would like to bring to your attention. I have had only about 7 months, honestly, doing this job, and I tried to come up with the best possible examples to give to you. And what I found is I really had to filter down to a few examples because on a daily basis, I find where someone comes into Community Action Team for something other than seeking veterans benefits, and they find out that this person is in fact a veteran and are able to go beyond providing services that Community Action Team has available and bringing them in to me and being able to provide them with multiple forms of assistance. So the power of the community network has served a lot of veterans in Columbia County just in the time that I've been there. One example that stands out in my mind is a lady who was a Vietnam-era veteran, unbeknownst to Community Action Team that she was a veteran. She was going to be homeless in approximately 2 weeks. She'd been a caregiver for elderly all her life since getting out of Vietnam. And she actually did not serve in Vietnam, but she served during that era. She was diagnosed with two serious illnesses and was no longer going to be able to be employed. When she came to CAT, they were working with her for housing assistance, and finding out that she was a veteran, we were able to put her in for non-service-connected pension at an expedited rate, and we were able to actually come and deliver her approval in her car as she was living in her car. And she was able to get back into an apartment, applied for VA medical care, and to me, I believe this is the difference between life and death for that veteran. Another example was just this last week of an 80-year-old gentleman, World War II veteran, who has been working all his life, still works at the Portland Airport at the age of 80 for Transportation Security Administration, has been virtually deaf and has had hearing aids at his own expense. He has tried and tried and tried through VA benefits to get service-connected for his hearing. We were just able to do that, and last week he received a check, a retroactive check for over $42,000. Once he got the check, he put in his retirement at Transportation Security Administration. He can retire in 1 month at the age of 80. And it is the power of coming into the CAT and seeing that not only are veteran services available to him, but had that fallen through, there would have been other services available, community action team, for this person. Right now, I'm working on a case of a veteran who has lives in the very, very remote areas of Columbia County and was just diagnosed with terminal lung and brain cancer. Prognosis is less than a year, is unable to work now, and is chances are very good he will become homeless in the next few months. So he came into CAT seeking housing assistance. The fact that he was a veteran and was already service-connected, he's being put in for not only the emergency assistance potentially available in October from Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but he's receiving assistance from Community Action Team, housing, and energy assistance to tide him over in the meantime should his unemployability be approved. These are just three examples, and there's so many more. What I want to stress is that the role of a veteran service office, I believe, and what we do is to go beyond just a face and a situation. We really look into the details and the very unique needs of these veterans and of people that walk into Community Action Team that didn't know veteran services might be available to them. We look at the fact that it's not a cookie-cutter approach, and I think this is making a huge difference in Columbia County. I just think that's the beauty of having a community network and having a lot more emphasis on veterans that's out in the media right now. And so I think it's only going to get better. So thank you.
Hi, my name is Barbara Wood, and as Jim said, I'm the Human Investment Director for Community Action Team. Thank you all committee members and co-chairs for inviting us today. A little tough to share the stage with those cute four-leggeds over there. I can't help but pay attention to those. So thank you for indulging us before you get to talk to the real stars of the show. As Grace said, the embeddedness of the veteran service program within the array of services at CAT enables us to do far more for individuals than we would be able to do if that office stood alone. Specifically, she's already talked about connections that we've made with homelessness and energy assistance. In addition to that, CAT also has senior services, foreclosure prevention, mortgage assistance, Head Start and Healthy Start, and then we make INR referrals, information and referral, to other county agencies. We couldn't do what we do with Grace's program without being embedded within CAT. There's a synergy that works, as she said. At the same time, it's a bit of a challenge to make it work. She is currently employed about 0.8% of FTE, and we could easily clone Grace and probably still not serve the need. There are, according to the U.S. Census, 6,000 veterans in Columbia County, and as a part of the grant I wrote, the Supportive Services for Veterans Family that Jim referred to, the SSVF grant, I did a lot of research into the numbers, and our best estimates are that there are 261 homeless veterans in our four-county region that will be served by this grant. Those are pretty staggering numbers when you think about it. There's a couple things that we do to get this to work. Right now, Grace has an assistant that does a lot of administrative support and scheduling and preparing veterans to bring in the right paperwork when they come to the office. We have arranged that through a partnership with WorkSource of Oregon, and so that person is basically receiving TANF as a part of their resources, and we have them for a six-month period of time. So that person is directed to support Grace in that way. That's one piece that we've done. In addition, as we've said, there's the supportive services for homeless veterans. That's a four-county grant we received from the VA, Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook, and Washington County. 1 year with, we hope, really strong possibility of refunding. I'll be coming back, hitting you up for another letter of support, I'm sure, come February. With that, we'll be able to provide housing and direct support services to 80 veterans. That's 15 veterans in each of the smaller counties and 35 in Washington County. Resources that we haven't had for years. It's terrific to be able to do that. The other thing I'm really excited about with that grant, besides the ability to provide housing and support service to the veterans, is the attention that it gives to the coordinated service delivery for veterans. A big part of the push of that grant is to create a wraparound service delivery system that meets their needs, that isn't just fragmented the way it is now. I actually have a meeting tomorrow afternoon with our county partners to start to work on that as a part of that grant. And that is, because that'll make systemic change for the long haul instead of just providing housing. The other thing that we're doing is we're working with the Corporation for National Services and have three VISTA volunteers that have just joined us as of last Tuesday. And one of them, her project is to create a veterans apprenticeship. And so we'll be working for the next year on putting that together. But at the end, we'll be able to train six veterans a year in weatherization, housing rehab, and multi-apartment maintenance to give them real living wage jobs. It's not a ton of people, but we hope that that will make a dent, and that if it gets off to a good start, we'll be able to expand that, perhaps to larger numbers in Columbia County or to our partner counties out in Columbia, in Clatsop and Tillamook County. So that's all that I have to say. Thank you again for all your time. If you have questions and comments, I'm sure we would be happy to answer those.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim. You had something.
I was simply going to just wrap up quickly, and then, if that's okay.
Sure.
So we see the same sort of iceberg headed toward our little ship Titanic that I think McKeel was talking about. It really looks to us, from what we see, we're still serving a lot of Vietnam era veterans. It looks to us like there's this big need that's rolling our way. And as the director at CAT, one of the things I worry about is the fact that this need could simply dwarf our ability to provide services to the wide variety of people that call on us for services. So this is a big threat to us. I challenged our board, in my opinion it is, I challenged our board with whether we would keep the program. Anytime we have something that has red ink, part of my job as executive director is to say, should we keep this and where would we get the money to backfill it? They were unanimous in saying this was an important need. They got the same feedback from our board, which has three county commissioners on it, and members of the community. So this is, for us, a priority. They've made this one of my priorities to work on. And in the process, we're trying to organize Columbia County outside of CAT, either as an advisory to CAT or an advisory to the county, some organizational thing to bring the community together to bear on these issues. So we're trying to find a way to get organized with it, but I just want you to know that as the director, looking at, we have a $10 million program at CAT, this is something that worries me, because the services that Barb talked about, our homeless services, our energy services, the other things that we do to assist people, could easily fall into just serving veterans, as what it looks like to me is that's where we're headed. So I'm not saying next year or the year after, but that seems to be the trend. And so we're worried about it and trying to take it seriously and get ourselves organized and ready as a community. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just recently been contacted by two veterans in my district, and one I was kind of surprised. He's a veteran in his 80s, like you were talking about, and needs a job, And I thought, wow. And I called somebody who worked with him before and said, yeah, he's, you know, he does, but he's not able, the kind of work he was doing, he's getting to the point where physically he won't be able to do it. It's outside work and a lot of heavy lifting, et cetera. But it kind of surprised me because he's a veteran, so I thought, and he said he needed money, extra money to live, and can't make it on his Social Security alone. He needs money for health care. He needs it. So it sounds like he's not connected to the services and may need some help with his housing. He still lives with his wife, and she can't work, and he's starting to have to take care of her health needs, et cetera. But the other one is the same kind of thing, only he's in his 50s, and he needs work, and he's healthy, strong, and he said he just can't find anything, and not even restaurant work. And I told him to go to the Veteran Services up there, and he said they just don't have anything for him. So without knowing all that, would he be a good candidate for a CAT team? Maybe talk to somebody different.
I assume you're speaking in Clatsop County?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So...
One's in Tillamook, one's in Clatsop.
Okay, so the complication I had been avoiding to keep from making you all go to sleep is our services are fragmented in the three-county area. Community Action Team serves all three counties, but we have two nonprofits we've helped create in Tillamook and Clatsop County because, from our perspective, it's not really possible to be local when your main office is in St. Helens. People in Tillamook are always going to feel like you're not local, and Astoria, it's the same way. So Clatsop Community Action and CARE in Tillamook might be a good connection there. The other fragmentation, and again, we work very closely with them. We pass through as much resources as they're willing to do. But the fragmentation then also comes on the veteran side, because I think I think in Clatsop County, it's an individual mm-hmm. the county hires, and I think it's part of county government in Tillamook. So the connection there with the VSOs would be different. So part of the message that we're trying to explain to you today, and that Grace touched on nicely, as did Barb, is having the Veterans Program housed at Community Action Team creates a synergy, because those other things, serving those needs are something that's part of our other duties. And so it would be easier for those people, for us to help them if they're in Columbia County. In Clatsop County, what I would try to do, if I can get their names and numbers, is connect them with CARE and Clatsop Community Action.
Okay.
And again, we have some jobs programs. So we can start doing some of the referral things that we would normally do. And because we're so closely connected with our partners on the coast, I'll handle that. Just if I could just know who they are.
I'll let you know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, all three of you, for all of the work you do. Thank you for coming here today and sharing the stories that you have with all of us. I'm struck by the work that you do, Grace, in terms of you make, at a minimum, a big difference in people's lives. An 80-year-old gentleman who finally gets to retire. I don't think any one of us ever envisioned the time when we would be expecting people to have to be working to the age of 80 in order to be able to sustain themselves. So thank you for making that difference, and thank you for actually saving lives. The woman that was living in the car is just it's just an unimaginable story. Jim has mentioned the fact that all of your services may be inundated by the needs of the veterans community here in the very, very near future. And I'm wondering, not to put any one of you on the spot, but maybe collectively, what are the handful, five or six things that you see in terms of shortage of resources? And I know one of them is money and the ability to clone Grace multiple times. But in addition to that, what are some of the things that you see as fundamentally necessary for your ability to be able to deliver services to veterans, and which this committee possibly could be of some assistance.
Yeah, go ahead.
And you guys pick up where I missed. Thank you, Representative Witt. I don't, off the cuff, I'm probably going to miss a lot.
Sure.
The first thing that comes to mind is that the, if I haven't been clear about that, Community Action Team is a nonprofit. I love to tell people I don't have a printing press in my basement. Somehow I have to manage to balance the budget. One of the ways that we do that is by being very scrupulous. For example, today when I fill out my timesheet for today, I'm going to have to put some effort on the veterans program. I'm going to have to show up there. Barb and I try not to do that because it cuts into what's available for Grace. And so managing really tight budgets is one of the challenges we have. And to do that, we narrow down to what we're actually paid to do and then what little extra we think we can afford to sneak under the rug. There isn't a lot of money to do some things that really need to be done. We're talking about some kind of a stand down or some kind of a running a homeless connect program, in large part because we want to connect with the veterans. The marketing stuff. Now, some of that's available. Like Mary said earlier, we bring things together to try and make them balance. Some of that we can have the SSVF program work for that. But we need some way to reach out and bring them into the communities, and it's kind of hard to find the resources to do that right now. So that's our big thing. There's housing is also an issue. There's a group of us that are working to propose at this coming legislative session an addition to the emergency housing account program that we use for homeless, that's specifically for veterans. And there's an effort to try and carve out a little bit of money specifically for them. I think that would be terrific. It would go nicely with the SSVF grant that we have. The beautiful thing about that grant, it's limited. We're talking 15 people in Columbia County. But the beautiful thing about that is it can wrap around a wide variety of services. So that's the short two things. The other thing is that there's the service suite that we have, the case management for homeless programs, the energy programs that we have. Those things are the things that we use to sustain people that are not able to work. The 80-year-old, the 50-year-old who can't find work. Again, even if it's in the case of the 50-year-old, even if it's a stopgap until he finds work in the next 12 months, some way to keep them in their home, some way to keep them there, applies to veterans as well as it does to a lot of other people that are not veterans. So those services are really limited. We turn away somewhere between 70% and 80% of the people who come to us who are homeless because we don't have enough resources to help them. So that's the environment in which I express my fear, because I know that the veterans are going to continue to be a problem. I don't expect the wave to necessarily, it's beginning. I don't think it's going to inundate us in the next year or two. But as we look from what I've seen, and Drace can address this better from her military background, but from what I've seen, we're looking at veterans that have been asked to do things that veterans in the past have not been necessarily asked to do. This has been the two wars that we've been engaged in have been really hard on our people. And I expect, just socially, we're going to have more trouble. And that's going to be our job. Mental health is another. Some way to reach out in the community. Transportation for veterans. So right now, if you're going to get veteran assistance for medical in Columbia County, you have to get to Pill Hill in Portland. That's not too bad from Columbia County. Pretty hard for Clatsop and pretty hard for Tillamook. Some way to help the VA reach out into those communities would be really helpful. Maybe we can do that through the CCOs. But that's something that we're talking about. I've already started some conversation with the head of the CCO. So, but that's the things I can think of. Let's see if Grace and Barb have other ideas.
Representative Witt, thank you for that question. I would second what Jim said, that a means of transportation and a means of more locally provided mental health capabilities for veterans that have a hard time making it to Portland VA. And there are some that are literally just in nursing homes and unable to actually get to the services that they need being in Portland. The thing that I see is there is a great need for successful outreach in the rural areas. There are a lot of underserved and unidentified veterans that don't even know that they have eligibility for veterans benefits. The downside of a successful outreach is that the demand will be so much greater than what I, as one person and community action team, can handle. I am already at a scheduling rate of 60 to 70 days out for a veteran to come in and see me. And so I'm a little hesitant to go all out, even with the use of volunteers, to have a very aggressive outreach, because I don't know that we can actually answer that mail if it comes in. And that's where I think we need a clone veteran service officer, and or at the least people that are interning or on staff that can actually support a veteran service officer and get into and have access to the confidential information of a veteran and know that they're covered and protected. So I do see a big potential onslaught as veterans return from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the data actually has shown that when they apply for veterans benefits, especially in the area of disability, that their number of claimed conditions are exponential almost compared to those who have been out of service for 30, 40, 50 years. They are coming in with very complicated issues, traumatic brain injury being one of them, neuro injuries, and claims. It is not uncommon to have a single disability claim that consists of 10 to 15 issues, which takes easily a year or more for that veteran to see compensation. And in the meantime, they're trying to struggle to get back integrated into society. And I see that demand increasing as they come back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was wondering if Barb...
I have just a couple more things. I'm going to quantify a little bit, if I might. I think CAD is really good at doing amazing things with a little amount of resources, but if we were truthful about what we need two Graces and a full-time administrative assistant to make this work and to actually serve the people that need to be served out there. That's even before the tidal wave comes. We need education support. We need housing. We don't have VASH vouchers in our county. We're working on getting them, but we don't have the housing vouchers that are specific to veterans. We need education support, healthcare support, as Jim said, transportation. The veterans, we are consistently hear from them, they don't want to use the public transportation. We do have that new transportation system that's in place. We're going to coordinate that and get that to work. But it's a barrier for people to get to Portland for their VA services. I think we need public relations, marketing, outreach, like Grace is talking about, but we need to have the resources and the staff in place to be able to deal with what's going to come through the door because of that. And then the thing I spoke about that the grant allows us to do of creating a coordinated service delivery system would be a huge thing to help this. Right now, veterans don't know where to go. As Representative Boone pointed out, there are our services, the VSO services through our office. There's somebody over at the employment division that's doing the education. There's somebody else doing employment. And there's no coordination to speak of. So that's one thing that we're going to take on with this grant. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I may have a follow-up. Barb, you talked about, I think it was 261 homeless vets. And was this a five-county area?
Four-county.
Four-county area. I'm I would imagine that this is no different than any other four-county area across our state. Could you very briefly describe the target of the grant that you're working under, as well as the parameters of it? And there may be other communities that could possibly benefit from these kinds of services.
The grant is designed to serve veterans and their families who are at 50% of area median income or less. Is that what you're meaning?
Yes.
Yeah, and they have to have received at least a, what is it called? I'm not a veteran, so apologize. Not a dishonorable discharge. They needed to have served and had a honorable. Other than dishonorable discharge. They need to be living at other, either in housing and they're at threat of losing it, or they need to be already homeless and then qualify with that 50% of area median income. And then they need to, basically it's what's called a housing first model. We put them into housing first, get them stable, and then surround them with other support services to help them stabilize and obtain housing stability for the long haul.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you all for the great job that you do. We're very proud of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Perry.
Thanks. So I live in West Lynn, and we do have some support up there. But I'm just curious about the transportation piece, because for a whole other issue, I plugged in on the TriMet, from West Lynn to Tualatin, from one end of my district to the other, and to get, from my house to Fred Meyer's is an hour and 33 minutes on the bus. So I can't imagine what it is to go from these counties, and try to use mass transit to get out there. So when you're talking about transportation, what are some of the solutions that you think that we need to understand and know about? Because I just can't see these guys trying to get on a bus and go,
Right.
A two-hour trip across town.
Right. And
plus,
I live in Portland and work in Columbia County, so I do the drive every day. And I looked into public transit. I looked into taking what's called Columbia County Rider, the bus system, and it would have taken me roughly 2 hours to get from my house, park, and cost $5 each way. And for a veteran who's struggling with homelessness and poverty issues, That's a no-brainer. That's not going to happen.
Just to be able to figure out the route.
Yeah.
So what do you guys do for transportation, or
what does Community Action do?
Yeah.
We give them bus vouchers when we have them.
Okay.
But we don't have an endless supply of those either. And then there was that. I think there were 6 buses that were deployed throughout Oregon. We received one of those. So a member of our county has put that into deployment for veterans. I believe it's working 1 day a week at this point. Is that what you understand?
At 1 day minimum, but as needed when there's availability of a driver.
If I could clarify, what this is there were some buses that were donated to communities that were going to specifically serve veterans. So Columbia County Rider, which is run by Columbia County, has a special bus that they're using for regular transportation 5 or 6 days a week, and then on the 1 day alone, because we can't use it effectively every day, so it makes no sense to park it. And so what they do is 1 day a week, we try to package that for veterans to move up there. The other thing we're hearing from the community is that veterans don't necessarily want... public transportation has a stigma to it, and it's hard sometimes to get them to agree to do that. I'm sorry if that upsets anyone, but it kind of does. For some people, and so that having them just on their own bus that's going to the VA
dedicated
works out a little better for us. So that is what we're trying to do with it. That's not a great solution. It'd be even better if we had a clinic that was 1 day a week in St. Helens, and maybe 1 day a week in Astoria, 1 day a week in Tillamook, so people could go at least to the county seat and get VA authorized services. There's a similar satellite clinic in Washington County, so they have something local there. We just don't.
I'm going to interject here. We're past our time on this allocation here. I think we should bring these people back and talk more, because I can see that this thing opens the door, and then there's 2 doors to open, and they open those 2 doors, there's 4 doors to open. So I'd like to do that, if you would do that,
yes,
Co-Chair, with me.
save those questions if we have any. Do you have any more?
No, that just the transportation one's a big deal. Light rail.
I have one question, and I would like a brief answer. Okay?
Hey, we'll try.
What about the county VSOs? Aren't we kind of
Grace, are you with
the county or are you with the nonprofit? I mean, I'm kind of confused here.
Columbia County contracted with us to do their VSO.
Oh, okay.
That's who we are.
What about the other counties?
The other counties have contracted with one, and the county in Tillamook does their own. So it's a part of county government in Tillamook. It's contracted out in Clatsop and Columbia.
Okay, but we're in Tillamook County, correct?
We're all three counties.
Okay, so is that, I guess I'm confused. If you're doing the job in Tillamook, why does the county have?
Grace and Barb and I work in Columbia County in St. Helens.
That's it.
So, yeah, Grace is the VSO for Columbia County alone.
Okay, now I'm seeing where the players are playing. Okay, got it.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I thought you were doing all three, and I was going to say, well, why do we have a county VSO if you're doing it in that county? So, gotcha. Thank you very much. I appreciate
you
being here.
Thank you very much.
General Caldwell, one of my favorite people.
Out to these far corners and get them services. That's a struggle.
You notice I do know the difference between a colonel and a general.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that.
Private and general?
Pardon?
Private and general?
Isn't he private the last time he was here?
Well, I
heard that. I remember hearing that.
Oh, really? I'm actually, I'm very good at being a private. That was one of my favorite ranks, actually. Mr. Co-Chair, both co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to come visit with you today. I think the previous discussions have been very, very enlightening, and I think it puts an exclamation point on many of the issues that this committee has been dealing with over the last several years, and some of the things that I think...
General, we know who you are, but for the record, your name, please?
For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and also the task force leader on the joint or the Japan tsunami debris problem here in Oregon. So I got rid of one hat since we last met. I'm no longer the director of Office of Emergency Management. They still report to me, but I've gotten rid of one of those jobs. So we're here today to discuss with you. And on my left is Colonel retired Dave Ferrey, who is the director of our what we call the J-9, but it's our reintegration program. This may be Dave's first visit here. And on my right, your left, is our Director of Family Programs, and Michelle Kachowski. And so they're here to answer your hard questions. And I'll do the overview, and they get to do the really hard questions. So I came prepared. So, again, it's good to be back in front of you. I want to talk to you today about community covenants that we're involved with, which is... it kind of ties in with the previous testimony of what we're trying to do at the behest of National Guard Bureau, and of course, as you can see on the slide, the presidential directives and a report that was given to the President of the United States from Joint Chiefs. And the idea, I think, is to not only is to try to, which we've been trying to do in Oregon for a number of years, is meld the stovepipes so we don't have stovepipes popping up and doing different things to get everybody kind of pulling on the same rope. And I think we've done a good job here in Oregon, but bottom line is that there's still more to do. And the mission that we have is to maximize the impact of the community resources that are available, both civilian and the military, and serve our members, our current members, our veterans, and the families. As you can see, our goal is to foster a sustainable network of local support, facilitate governmental, non-governmental, nonprofit, corporate partners, and local citizens collaboration, and fill service and information gaps, which, again, I think your question, finding out who the players are in the previous testimony and who does what, I think is really important. And so this, I think, fits right in with what we're discussing. As you can see, we have in our J-9, Military Children Education Coalition, which Representative Parrish is a main player on, Partners in Care, and, of course, our Community Covenant. And, again, we're trying to get everybody talking on the same issues. 2008, Secretary of the Army initiated this program and wanted to raise the awareness mobilize support in American communities, embrace all branches and all components. As we've talked here many times in this building, we're kind of the only game in town. We have other reserve components, but they're smaller. They're not as well distributed as the Guard is, as the National Guard is, and the active component is basically absent. There isn't major active duty components here in the state of Oregon. Last major active duty component was actually sitting out at Umatilla Army Depot, and I'm here to tell you today that we're the proud new owners, I guess, is lack of actually where the caretakers right now is that Umatilla Army depot is in the transition during the base realignment and closure process. So we've taken that duty over from the Army, and essentially there is no active duty personnel left on that base. So it's DOD civilians and the National Guard are operating that. So Oregon is kind of one of the few states that doesn't have any major active duty components and bases. Again, our principals are service members and their families need support in local communities, and sometimes they don't get that through the VA. They don't get it through us or other programs that may be out there, and they end up at the county, typically, and the county ends up absorbing those costs and using resources that are valuable for other citizens that perhaps could be resourced through the Veterans Administration and or other sources, and we're trying to make those connections so when we see that happen in the local community, we can actually get the individual, the veteran, and or the service member to the right spot. And many times that's the key, as was indicated by Representative Boone earlier testimony. I think sometimes the veterans just don't know what's available to them, and so getting them tied into the right place is absolutely essential. And how it works is that, as you can see, we're working with social services, faith-based groups, chambers, veteran service organizations, and essentially anybody in the community that has an interest in this and sees this on a daily basis, and we're trying to coordinate that at the local level. And then put a collaborative network together so we can talk about the eaches in those communities and not try to manage it from up on high. We're going to have, once we get our meetings done and our groups together in these communities, we'll have a signing ceremony so we can get some press on this to make sure the local people know what's going on in their communities. And we'll have those, of course, displayed in very prominent places within those communities so people can see them as a daily basis. We'll have military liaisons in these communities, point of contacts, our military leadership, where we have armories and we have people. We have 38 armories scattered around the state. They will be tasked with helping to coordinate this as a single point that can actually work in that community. We don't have an armory in every community. We wish we did, but we can hardly support the ones we have. But we pretty much cover the regions, and everybody pretty much knows where we're at. And our staff, Colonel Ferre's staff, they'll also be the coordinator at the state level for this. And we'll provide support from the military department as well. National Guard Bureau, of course, they measure everything, and they're going to measure, they want metrics to find out how well we're doing in Oregon. Again, we're ahead of the game because we've been doing this in our summits that many of you have attended. I'm looking specifically here to, I think all of you have been to our summits. So you know that we've been trying for a number of years now to pull these disparate groups together and have these conversations so we can find, and those have been very revealing, that we find out there's all sorts of different groups that are doing wonderful things, but one right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. That was the objective 7, 8, 9 years ago when we first started the summits and first started our reintegration program, which I believe we started in 2003. So we've been at it for 9 years, recognizing this problem 9 years ago. Now, we haven't solved all the problems, but I think we've got a much better conversation going between the different groups and the different partners that want to help and have good resources that can help and help us identify these issues. And, of course, the Bureau will measure all of those. So, in summary, I think this is a... Go ahead. Oh, implementation. Did I miss one? Oh, yes.
Good thing you have a colonel there to correct
you. Yeah, I got a colonel here to help me out. I'll just look at this. I'll let you look at the slide because I apparently didn't get this in mind. But
nice.
This year, this is where we're going to be. Klamath Falls, Medford, Ashland, Grants Pass, Pendleton, Hermiston, Milton, Clearwater, Umatilla, LeGrand, Baker City, Ontario, Burns, Bend, Redmond, Prineville. That'll be in this fiscal year until 2013. And then in 2013, objective being trying to get out to the out into the regions where the weather's going to turn nasty now. We can focus when the weather gets worse. We can focus back on the Willamette Valley and the coastal region so we can get our teams out there. So that's kind of the implementation program, and you can see every one of these towns that you see up here, we have an armory. And so, again, that shows you that, you know, we're pretty well scattered across the state, as you all well know. And we think if we can pull in those other communities that don't have a particular armory, we'll get most of the counties. Of course, Wheeler, Gillum, and a few of those we don't have armories in, but we'll use the Dalles, and we'll use, you know, Hermiston and or Central Oregon for outreach to them. So, in summary, again, we want to inspire this new program to support geographically dispersed service members, build resilience, reduce the stress on service members, veterans, and families. Use our hometown networks that are already established in supporting service members and the veterans, and heighten awareness in the communities to make sure that they know when they do find somebody like you had a call on, Representative Boone, that you'll have a point of contact that we can kind of network in some of these other groups. So that pretty much summarizes what we're doing with respect to our this new effort. It is a continuation of our old effort, just a different little bit different twist on what we've been doing. Instead of having everybody come to Salem for a summit, we're going out to them now. I might also add that Colonel Foray, after he took over, instead of having one summit here in the Salem area, which was pretty consistent, people got used to it, now we're actually doing regional summits. They're a little smaller, but it's actually we're going to the people instead of the people coming to us. So that concludes our briefing, and I or my colleagues left and right, who are really the certified smart people in this thing, we'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Do you have anything to say, Colonel?
Thank you, sir.
Any questions? Yes, Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Caldwell, I'm just curious whether any of the community covenants have already been implemented or are already in existence.
No, sir, they have not.
Okay. Thank you.
Just a comment. I think I might have shared before that we went out to Ontario, Oregon for an event. And, you know, there's some challenge. There are some folks out there who really don't feel like this side of the mountains hears them. So it was interesting to be out there and hear that. So I'm glad to see that your schedule for the fall really focuses on areas that, you know, frankly are at other side of mountains or, you know, farthest corners of the state, because they really don't feel like they're being heard. And that was feedback I got from them. They don't feel like they're invited onto task force or, you know, most of our folks are really metro area and they're not, you know, or Salem or, you know, even Eugene, Albany, but that they're not quite as invited to the table and they'd like to be. So anyway, I just thought that was a feedback I got from them and I thought I'd share that.
I understand of being the red-headed stepchild in Southern Oregon, doesn't it?
Yes,
Representative Boone.
Thank you. Well,
by the way, you can come to Medford anytime. We always have nice weather.
I know you do.
Yes, sir.
No, I just want to make a comment. Thank you again. Every time I see General Caldwell come up, I think, oh, what's he doing now? You know, this is great.
Trouble.
Great news, and you always do the right thing and do it well. So thank you.
I might add, in the previous testimony, there was discussion about employment issues, and that's a very difficult situation to address. But we have one good news story that really isn't part of this briefing, and we're going to brief it tomorrow in front of the Senate Vets Committee. But you recall that 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, was deployed about a year ago. They just got home about a year ago. And that's basically Eastern Oregon. It starts in the Dalles, runs down Interstate 84, and ends up in Ontario. Very difficult job markets out there. There's no question about that. When we surveyed the soldiers in Iraq, in Iraq before they came home, 62% of them were unemployed, or employed, 31% unemployed, which is pretty typical. We've been telling you this for a number of years. About a third of our people identify themselves as not employed when they get home. We were fortunate Senator Wyden was instrumental in getting some additional federal resourcing for us. Colonel Foray organized the staff. We hired soldiers, basically, from these units. We placed, he brought them in, worked with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the Oregon Employment Department. brought them in, trained these individuals, and we had an individual in each single armory, and their main focus and only focus was to try to network locally, just like we're talking now with the community covenants, to try and get these people employed. At the time, we had about 176, roughly, unemployed soldiers when they got off the bus, when they came home. And today, less than a year later, we're down to 19. And I would probably suggest that those 19 would rather hunt and fish and live on unemployment than actually go to work. That's my guess. I don't know that for a fact, but that's knowing those boys over there and girls, that's not an unreasonable expectation. But I think it goes to what was previously mentioned about resourcing, and I think if you have the proper resources and you employ them properly, as I think we did in this example, we saw great results. We've never seen results like this, and that's a tough job market anyway. The jobs just aren't over there like they are in other places of the state. Their unemployment consistently is 1 to 2 points higher, sometimes 3 points higher than here on the west side. So we're really a firm believer. Again, we got some extra money. There was no strings on it. We were able to create what we wanted to create, and we had an idea. We implemented it. Colonel Frey and his staff did a fantastic job, and I'm just extremely pleased with the results that we got with not a lot of money. That wasn't a ton of money. And so focusing those resources at a very finite level and giving them one job to do and only one job to do really made a difference in this case, and I think we're better off for that.
Well done, General. I do want to say that I think Co-Chair Witt and I can sympathize with the people that rather hunt and fish. The second thing that comes to my mind is these funds will dry up because this country cannot continue on a $1 trillion deficit per year. It's got to come to a halt sometime. So what is your plans in the future when it does?
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a difficult challenge because, like I said, we've seen examples where we didn't have that resourcing, and we can, we keep working at it with other duties as assigned because we've seen the reduction in monies coming from the federal government. And we have limited success, but I think the last time before we had these resources, we were able to get the unit within a year down to 12% unemployment, which is not bad, but it's still pretty much national norm. And in this case, I don't know what that percentage, 3%. So we were able to get it down to 3%, with that resourcing. Now, I think to the taxpayers, and talking about return on investment, there's a tremendous savings when these people go to work. One, they're producing and they're creating tax revenue. Number two, they're not taking unemployment. And the cost of this program was about 3 to 1. The cost gained by not having them on unemployment was 3 times greater by spending the money up front, which we did. So there is a savings to the taxpayer. It reduces that unemployment load that can go on for 18 months, I think, in some cases. And so we were able to pull them off of the dole, put them to work, and make that contribution. So I think it's about smart investments more than anything else. I think that's what we really got to look for, and we also got to look at any investment that we make, has that kind of return or has a good return. Not everything's going to work out that way. We didn't know that it would work out that way. We hoped it would. But I think with that focus, we were able to really maximize the use of those tax dollars. And I think that's a good thing for the taxpayer.
Thank you, General.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, thanks as always. Really appreciate it. I guess I'm curious. You were talking about like a specific amount of money, not much, but directed towards one mission and one cause. And we talked a while back about lottery funds and the potential for possibly using those types of funds for VSOs or specific funds. Is that something that you're still considering or looking at, or is that still part of a conversation when we talk about veterans and services and getting these folks back to work? Or so where would you be on that?
Co-chairs and Representative Matthews, again, I think anytime we can take resources and focus them directly, we're going to make money. And not only are we going to make money, and it was, again, your earlier testimony indicated that the dollars coming in from the Veterans Affairs, there's a tremendous amount of money. I don't remember the exact dollars. Paul Evans is in the room. He'd probably have it off the top of his head. But there's a tremendous amount of VA dollars that get left on the table in Oregon. And one of the efforts in the previous administration under Governor Kulongoski, as you recall, and Paul was running that for the governor, was to get out and get veterans signed up so at least we could get into the game, even though they may not need the services. And I think that still applies today. I had a meeting a couple weeks ago with the director of the VA hospital in Portland, and you know they're pouring everything they can with their resourcing, but they also admit that they've had an increase, a noticeable increase, in the number of veterans that have signed up in Oregon in the last 2 years. I think that's directly related to what Governor Kulongoski did with his efforts, and I think that's helped us because of one of the things that's coming out of that is Salem, for instance, is scheduled to get a brand new clinic in this community, and that's directly related to how many veterans they're serving. And that'll be a larger clinic than the little one they have right now. They'll be able to serve more. They're going to put more staff in it. So that's all related to this whole subject matter. And again, working with the communities like you had in previous testimony, what we're trying to do and keep emphasizing these things is going to help us with respect to the federal government. I think this administration at the national level, and I suspect that if it changes, that the next one will be equally as inviting to veterans. I think that the veterans are clearly in people's minds right now, and they're not going to push them to the curb. So I think it's incumbent on us to get as many veterans as we can into the system so the numbers are correct, so we get the proper resourcing and bring those dollars back to Oregon.
Thank you. And follow-up? And just a comment. I really appreciate the community covenant concept and what you're doing there. And your comment about the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing. I think there's a lot of folks that have great intentions, and they want to help our veterans in every way. But if we don't make the coordinated effort, we're really going to have little impact. And so we got to get everybody together, talking the same language, you know, speaking the same speak, and appreciate your efforts in doing that. And, Colonel, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of missile silos that are not connected.
Correct. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, no.
Not a good thing on a bad day, is it?
Co-chair Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Caldwell, that's just a stellar performance, the number of people that you've been able to help put back to work given the level of unemployment. And we're very grateful to all employers who employ our members of the service. Are there any particular employers who've gone the extra mile that maybe we should recognize the tremendous job that they've done?
Mr. Co-Chair, indeed, you know, a couple of them come to mind right off the top of my head. Harvey Platt Electric has been basically a saint. He almost will make a job for a veteran if they show up.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember the number he's hired, but it's been extensive. The most promising thing on the horizon, and I got to tell you, we've had great response from our business community. They have really stepped up in every corner of the state. But one of the ones that's extremely exciting right now is Colonel Foray and his staff, and we met here about a month ago with Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente in the Portland area, and of course Washington County has one of the highest numbers, if not the highest number of veterans on the rosters. They're building a new hospital out at Hillsboro. They came to us by virtue of another connection through Oregon Business Development, Tim McCabe, who I know you're familiar with, the director. Happened to be sitting at a dinner with the chief head of Kaiser for the Northwest, and he mentioned, he said the Kaiser head was interested in trying to see how what he could do to help the veterans community, and he's not a veteran. And he hooked us up together. I grabbed these guys. We went up and met. They got 600 new jobs that they're going to hire for that hospital. Everything from the butcher, baker, candlestick maker, yeah, to a brain surgeon, to you know, somebody doing the security, to lawn work. And it's just across the board. And they want very much to not only hire veterans, but they want to help train them on how to respond to the application process. We do those kind of trainings. They want to take it a step further, have mock interviews, help them with their resumes so they get into the hunt and not just come to us. Yeah. We're going to teach you how to win the job when you get in the room. Now, that's extremely exciting for us, and we hope we can model that and push that out to other corporate interests that have come to us and said we want to help. So that's probably the best news that we've heard in a long time.
Tremendous. Thank you.
Representative?
Thanks. Can I just ask, do you have a current unemployment rate for Oregon for military?
Oregon National Guard?
Well, just veterans in Oregon. Do you have a kind of a current
I don't have that,
rate?
No.
Okay.
I we've got.
Okay, we have to move along here.
Yeah, it was about 11%, Dave says, is what he remembers in December.
Okay.
So
thank
you for it's hovering around the national average.
Thank you for your stellar work. I appreciate that very much, being a veteran.
These folks do the work.
Oh. That's
okay, General. I know how it works in the military.
I get to come visit with you.
That's right. You get to take the bow. So good work, good job, especially with the employment rate. That's phenomenal. That really is. So I appreciate your work.
We've learned some things, and we're trying to learn.
Representative Matthews and I thought maybe we'd sign up to see if they could turn us into a brain surgeon.
Just a thought. Well, that little quiver in your hand may prevent something.
That's right. It may stop something. So thank
you. I wouldn't worry about it. I'm sure you can qualify.
Oh, you got to stay here, General, because you're on with Major Abbott.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah.
We're going to go to an update on Homeland Security.
We got a larger list than that.
Sign me up.
Coach, I forgot. Is it Major or Colonel?
Oh. It'll be Major for life, sir.
Okay.
Many reasons for that, sadly. Coach Ariscoval, Coach Erwitt, always got to start off with something like that, you know. In fact, it reminds me of Brigadier General Ted Roosevelt. They landed a mile south on Utah Beach. Everything was kind of behind him, and he finally said, we're going to start the war from here.
By the way, Paul, we need your name for the record.
Trouble? T-R-O? No. My name is Paul Evans. I live at 744 Main Street East, Monmouth, Oregon, until they run me out. I'm here today really not so much to talk about Homeland Security Emergency Management in the big sense, because I no longer have the opportunity or the role or the responsibility to do that. I'm just a hobby lobbyist now on those things, but I am a part of something that we've talked about in a number of us in different occasions that is related, and actually is related to the veterans issues as well. Portland State University, through the Hatfield School of Government, the Center for Public Service, like the longest title in the universe, has put together an Emergency Management Homeland Security Professional Development Program. I'm going to slow down and say that again. It's a professional development program for emergency management and homeland security professionals. And it is unique in many ways. And I'm here today to make a plug. I'm also here to challenge each one of you to become personally involved. It is a combination of a private, public, and nonprofit approach to resiliency, something that FEMA actually has been preaching. It's an answer for a lot of us that have been looking for opportunities to raise the dialogue, raise the opportunities for folks to get to know each other and get to work together before the big event. I found it interesting that I was in Florida this last week briefly, and there was an earthquake or two that happened while I was gone, and it wasn't the big one, thank God, but it was another couple of earthquakes. So I was like, wow, good timing. All right. The classes actually start Friday this week. We have 13 students involved in this program. It's designed specifically around what the International Association of Emergency Managers call the Certificate of Emergency Management. In simple terms, it's very similar to medical school in the boards or law school in the bar. We're trying to tailor our program to be able to help folks be in a good position to be able to get through the CEM so they're accredited internationally. That's the gold standard. We're also trying to reach out to especially veterans, because of the GI Bill and a number of other student groups, but specifically folks that traditionally, when they return from war, have migrated toward the law enforcement and firefighting fields because of the sense of mission, the sense of camaraderie. The unique thing about emergency management and homeland security in terms of resiliency is it's something that everybody recognizes they need more of, both in the corporate world as well as in the public world. And there's more opportunities there. It's one of the projected growth industries for the future. So what we're trying to do is, in simple steps, build something very similar to the research triangle that they did in North Carolina, but do that here in Oregon around emergency management and resiliency. And largely through the work that each of you have done on different committees, having to do with ocean policy and emergency preparedness and resiliency and getting ready for the big earthquake that we know will happen, but we all pray will be after our watch, this program is something special. And I hope and encourage all of you to be a part of some of the upcoming events. We actually have Chief Lane Roberts, who was, still is the police chief in Joplin, and And we also have Ms. Kay Goss, who actually built the FEMA Emergency Management Institute, their training program under former President Clinton and James Lee Witt. They're coming out next weekend to actually be a part of a kickoff celebration. So that's really what I was hoping to talk to you about today. I truly believe that this is one of those opportunities where government and private sector and nonprofits can come together and do something that is both good for society as well as provide an opportunity for a laboratory where private companies could test new products, nonprofits could test new systems, and everybody could actually end up benefiting. Last little plug, since it was mentioned earlier, the number is about $4.2 billion we're leaving on the table every year. And there was a bill last session, and there may very well be again, if I can get enough legislators to, well, support it, lottery funds for veterans programming. Because, again, veterans programming is money that comes in that is force multiplier dollars. It's not bank dollars. It's money that's generated to actually provide skills and dollars coming into the state that can get veterans involved. So just had to get that in. Any questions for me?
I'd just like to mention, I am interested in bringing the lottery piece back. People know I'm not a...
From your lips to God's ears, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
But I am. But I'm not a fan of how we do it because of some of the problem gambling issues that come with it. But I sit on a group that we've been looking very deeply at the lottery and problem gambling. And one of the things that's come out of that is just the scope and size of the advertising budget. And when you actually do a return on investment for our colleagues on Ways and Means, who we're going to have to convince of this, but those dollars are there if we ask them to make some changes to how they use that particular pool of money, mm-hmm. because their advertising budget in a biennium is about $30 million. And the majority of their money comes from one source, the video poker, which they spend less than $1 million a biennium advertising that. So I think that there's some room to trim some of the lottery does good things types ads and redirect to other things, educational, and that you will see something coming from my office.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Parrish, if I could for just a minute on that. Thank you for continuing to push that issue and to find the resources. I just spent this last week at a military function down in Florida with 1,500 former demons, that's the name of the unit, and all of us had been deployed 3, 4, or 5 times. And I wasn't on the Titanic, I don't know an iceberg from a big chunk of ice, but I can tell you that we have precious little time because the trains are coming. And I can also tell you that the world isn't going to get any easier. One of the reasons I look the way I do today and I'm in somewhat of a sarcastic mood is because, again, we had embassies hit across the United States and we lost an ambassador because there are still people out there that don't always agree with our policies. And that's fine, as long as they don't kill our people. We're now in a situation where with budget deficits, we're going to be deploying, depending more and more on the Guard Reserve, more and more on the active duty that's getting smaller, 80,000 by the last cut from the Secretary of the Army for next year. We have to have these systems in place, and they have to be sustainable. And you're right, I don't like the lottery as the best option. If I could have general fund, I would, well, I won't tell you what I would do, but lots of probably horrible things. But I would to do that to get the money. But lottery funds is what we have. It is available, and it is something that I believe you wouldn't have to spend a whole lot of money on advertising, because if people understood that it was going to veterans, I think you'd actually have to spend less on advertising because there's an intuitive perspective.
So we can use
right.
for other things.
Right, but if there's a percentage that they say you have to have X amount of dollars spent for a game to be successful, I don't think that standard would hold for a veterans lottery, because I think the message would get out.
Okay.
But thank you all for doing what you're doing, and thank you all for pushing these issues and not letting them die, because it's not sexy to talk about veteran stuff right now. But we need you to talk about it now more than ever before.
General? Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, referenced the topic, Homeland Security Council and Community Partnerships, which we've already talked about, the community partnerships, but our Homeland Security Council, as you know, was revamped. It's smaller, it's more nimble at this point. I will tell you that we're meeting this fall again with the council. I think the key is that one of our major concerns that we've had, and we're working with the new Attorney General, is the maintenance and the sustainment of our fusion center that we have here in Oregon. That's proven to be a very valuable asset
to law enforcement and to other issues, other important issues, working with the federal government and the FBI and the other federal law enforcement entities. That's struggled financially. Current Attorney General appears very supportive at this point, and we're continuing to work with it, trying to direct what federal resources that we can through FEMA and other sources to keep it up and keep it running. We think it's essential and vital to the operations. I think the Superintendent of the State Police would agree, and he was here, and I think that that has proven in many instances to be a very valuable asset. So that's our primary focus at this point, because that's where you connect all the dots. The one thing that is reminiscent of 11 years ago, yesterday, was we weren't connecting dots. And I think that we're past that now. I think we're past that in a very positive way, but we've got to sustain it. We can't start nibbling away at it, taking it away, and a dollar here and a dollar there. That's an important investment, and I think we have to continue to do that. So that will be a major topic as we move into the next session to make sure that we can sustain that, regardless of who the Attorney General is. At that point, we'll sit down with that Attorney General and once the elections are over and revisit that, which we've already done with the current Attorney General. So that's a pretty quick snapshot update. I think you're going to get some further testimony behind us, which will also help you frame this in your minds. I would like to ask new director of the Office of Emergency Management, Lieutenant Colonel retired Marty Plotner. He's in the back of the room. Marty, if you'd stand up, please, so you can get a look at this young man who's coming in to solve all those problems that I was unable to solve in my two-year stint. So, and he'll do a fantastic
baton,
job. So if you really got a homeland or you got an emergency management question, ask him. So. Happy to answer any questions or turn it over to the next group.
All right. Co-Chair Esquivel, pass the baton here. And we share our each and every one of our meetings. So with that, are there any further questions for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And with that, I'd like to call up, please, Cameron Smith, Robbie Roberts, and Debbie Guerra. And if I missed anyone else with this panel, please let us know. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Please decide among yourselves the
we'll
order in which you'll...
let Robbie go first.
No pressure. Co-Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate today very much the opportunity to come and talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is emergency management and the coordination or lack thereof between the public and private sectors.
Would you please, sir, introduce yourself for the record?
I will. Thank you. Robbie Roberts, Northwest Natural.
Thank you.
Been aboard with Northwest Natural for about 7 years. I come by my emergency management experience from the public sector. I retired from the Portland Police Bureau as a sergeant and from the United States Coast Guard Reserve as a Captain 06. So I've done a little bit of emergency management in the field side, and now we're doing a little bit more in the planning and coordination side. So we at Northwest Natural obviously take emergency management very seriously. Our commitment to our customers and the public sector is that we will provide service regardless of circumstance. And we have a significant pipeline integrity program. We have a significant training program for our first responders, all of our field personnel. And we understand that it's important for us to provide that service, to be able to respond and to be able to actually take care of any emergency situation. However, we also recognize that we cannot do that in a vacuum, that particularly in a disastrous situation, there are times when we are interdependent with so many other folks in both the public and the private sectors that we are significantly working on getting that coordination and cooperation between the public and private sectors. Here about 4 years ago, Northwest Natural, at the behest of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, joined with Pacific Power and Portland General Electric and the Bonneville Power Administration to form a small committee called the Energy Emergency Management Team. And recognizing the criticality of the critical infrastructure that we provide with electricity and gas, we began working on several initiatives to help forward the process of coordination between all the sectors and all of the various pieces of the pie that provide the entire infrastructure for the state. For example, we, as a group, worked closely with the energy assurance plan, both at the state level and the local levels, here in Salem, for example, and the city of Portland. And also, we recognized the need for this close cooperation and coordination of all these various pieces that are working on little pieces of emergency management. I'll give you some examples. There's a small committee called EPIC. It's the Emergency Planning for Infrastructure and Commerce. It's primarily aimed at a small group of private sector folks from mom-and-pop stores to some bigger outfits, but they're kind of working in a vacuum. There is the OCPA, the Oregon Continuity Planners Association, and again, it's a relatively small group, and they're kind of working in a vacuum, but they have some big players. For example, they have Intel, Standard Insurance, and some other pieces, and they're working on their issues. There's REMG, the Regional Emergency Management Group, which is primarily the metropolitan area up in the Portland area. It's a great group. It's very well diverse, a lot of players, but it's primarily public. And the private sector is participating, but not really recognized as a significant player. So, and that's just three. There are other groups that are working. We talked earlier about the silo issue, and I think that's what we're talking about here. So, about 4 years ago, the EEMT got together, and through the good work of Debbie Guerra from Pacific Power, we went down to Utah to observe their program, Be Ready Utah. And it is what I would consider a gold standard. It has taken many, many factors of the private sector and melded them in a close cooperative effort with the public sector to provide emergency management and disaster response when needed. For example, they have pulled together banking, emergency services, energy, public health, telecommunications, retail, and transportation into one group under what is called the Utah Private Sector Homeland Security Coordinating Council. And that council is actually chaired by the Lieutenant Governor of the state and co-chaired by the President of the Salt Lake City Chamber of Commerce. And we were able then to observe their annual or their monthly meeting, actually, and observe their exercise, which they conduct at least once every quarter. There were at least 50 people there representing all of these sectors that I've mentioned. It was interesting to see all the players in one room playing in the same game and providing input for all of the leaders for these response situations. It was very interesting and very well done. We also met with the manager of the program, who provides a single point of contact, the liaison for all of those groups, the various companies from all the sectors I mentioned, and from the public sector folks, the emergency managers, the various counties and cities and state, to provide that one single point of contact in order to coordinate the activities in the event of a disaster. And this is the planning, the mitigation, and the response part that this liaison position actually coordinates. When we came back, we pushed hard as the EEMT for a public-private liaison position in OEM, Office of Emergency Management. And I'm happy to report that OEM, through the good graces of General Caldwell and now Lieutenant Colonel Plotner, are in the process of final selection for this position. And we look forward very much to coordinating our activities as the EMT and working with the other groups I mentioned earlier to provide that overall coordination of this effort. And that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unless there's anything pressing that the committee members have? I'd like to hold questions until the panel's completed, if that works for everyone. Okay. Who's next?
Thank you. Co-chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Debbie Guerra, and I'm the director of our transmission and distribution dispatch and emergency management for Pacific Power. As you know, Pacific Core is an electric utility that serves 1.7 million customers across the western United States, and 555,000 of those are customers are Pacific Powers in Oregon. The company's primary goal is to provide safe, reliable, low-cost electricity to its customers. We make every effort to keep the power on for our customers because we realize that any outage, no matter how long it lasts, imposes a significant burden on our customers. So in the past, private and public response to emergencies haven't always been formalized or coordinated. Over the past couple of years, we have been working hard to influence change that will ensure coordinated response and recovery across the state. I can say that we are currently working with the state to help fill the public-private liaison sector position and who will really be responsible for integrating the public-private stakeholder community in all phases of emergency management. We really believe this role is important and will lead to a better coordination across the sectors. And, you know, to throw in the motherhood and apple pie component of this, through public-private partnerships, both government and private sector can, you know, really enhance all of the situational awareness, improve decision-making, access more resources, expand reach and access for communication efforts, improve coordination with other efforts by segment of the private sector, increase the effectiveness of emergency management efforts, maintain strong relationships built on mutual understanding, and create a more resilient communities. We're ecstatic that the state is devoting resources to this effort, and we hope that, believe that coordination amongst the public and private entities will ensure the state communities are prepared for any contingency. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, senior policy advisor for Governor Kit Sauber, and I am both blessed and cursed to work in what I consider to be some of the broadest areas of our policy on veterans and emergency management. I think the only other one that's probably broader or equally broad is probably economic development in terms of a catch-all. And I appreciate the theme running throughout both on the veteran side and the emergency management side is that coordination, is the partnerships. We talk a lot about public-private partnerships. It gets tossed around as a term, but it is true in these two areas. As state agencies, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the Office of Emergency Management cannot do it all. When you look at veterans, we've got education, healthcare, jobs, housing, transportation, across a range of war generations and war eras, across urban and rural. On emergency management, we have the different sectors, and the power and utility community gets it, but we have transportation, hospitals, emergency services, food and water, shelter, communication, and those are also across different disasters in terms of floods, fires, storms, earthquakes, tsunamis, and then on the terrorism side. So waking up every day and knowing where do you apply your energy on those big, broad areas is difficult, but in a limited budget with difficult revenues, the only way we're going to make progress going forward is on the partnership side. So on the emergency management, we're still in, you know, I was hoping we'd be out of the fire season by now, but we're still in the thick of summer weather. Makes for a nice September, but if you look at fires just at that one level, you get the Department of Forestry, the State Fire Marshal, OEM, the military on search and rescue, the tribes, the cities and counties in terms of fire departments, sheriffs, and 911, the federal overlay. If we're not coordinating, we're not going to make progress. So while on the emergency management side, the Homeland Security Council was more tailored and more narrowed down, still a lot of support for that public-private partnership in terms of that staffing. If OEM is simply a heavy grant organization and simply a pass-through of FEMA dollars on the back end, will have failed in our mission. That's a critical component and takes a huge component of a huge part of their staffing right now in terms of, you know, when the disasters, when the news has moved on, OEM staff are still doing a lot of project management and administration and accounting. So that is a huge part of their effort right now. I've always thought we do well in terms of coordinating across our state agencies. We do reasonably well coordinating up to the feds and down to the local level, but we haven't had the broader staffing to do a lot of the outreach directly to the citizens and then also to the business, faith-based, nonprofit community. So I think with this one position, we begin to prove the concept and begin to come back for further efforts.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel members? Yes, Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to thank you all, and I know you're working hard to get the resilience plan done, and you made a comment about having the people in the room, and that was really stunning to me. The first meeting that task force had, there were probably over 100 people in the room at Port of Portland, and I just remember everybody sharing lunches because they'd only expected about 75. But people are working, and I'm really happy, Cameron, that you're doing what you're doing. And I think it's blessing more than a curse, but, you know, you're young. You'll get over that. it's really good to have our governor behind us in this effort. And I appreciate all that you're doing. And I was just very happy to see how much has been going on. I sit on Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, and it's become a very active component in this process. So thanks very much for what you're doing. It's much appreciated. And, you know, I always tell people I'm about 12 miles inland from the tsunami hit zone or inundation zone. So if you're at the beach, come to my house. And they did during the test last time. I was here. You know, they were at my house. So I appreciate everything you do. Thank you.
I'm curious what steps the two of you in the private sector might recommend that we in the public sector consider to better coordinate perhaps our efforts. I'm also interested in maybe key lessons to be taken away from the gold standard that Utah has established, and possibly what question do we need to ask, be it of Utah or anywhere else, in terms of what we need to be doing or what we could do better or differently?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, to answer the second question first, I think the key to the success of the Utah model is their organization. And I think it's basically organized around what are the emergency support functions in the ICS system. And it helps to break into categories those businesses and the public sector which supports those businesses in order to coordinate activities at the time of disaster. And I think that was one of the things that impressed me the most. Two, they have a very significant outreach program, which has reached many of the private companies. And also the sales pitch that has been done to the public sector in various departments at the local and county and state level. They are very much in tune to working together. And they recognize the private sector as that critical component, because the lights are on because Debbie has power. And when the lights go out, it's she that's going to put them back on. We as public responders, my whole life, and we didn't have much to do with that. We tried to clear the roads, provide traffic control and security, and do those kinds of things that the public sector does best to provide that avenue for the lights to come back on, miraculously sometimes. So that is an important component, to have the public sector recognize the importance. My experience has been in various meetings, there's a lot of lip service given to the importance of the private sector, but sometimes, especially at time of disaster, those things kind of go out the window, and they're more concerned with doing their public response, which is important, but they forget about the criticality of critical infrastructure folks, gas, electric, water, that is necessary to provide that foundation to get things going again.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would say that I spoke to Ryan Longman, who is the liaison for Utah yesterday, and I said, could you give me two things that were, you know, you look at as wins within your program? And one was, you know, and I totally agree with him on this, is the fact that you have that handshake with somebody prior to an event, that you know who to call, they know that you are the right person, that you have the authority to ask for that information. And that if there are resources that you have available that, or they have available, you can share them. Because in a disaster, we all look for the same resources. And in 2007, I'm sure that everybody remembers the storm on the coast, and we were very heavily involved in that. General Caldwell was very instrumental in helping us with some of our response and recovery because we were looking for fuel and some other things. I think that the other thing that I, when I asked Ryan was, what was the other thing? He says, you know, through all the fires in Utah, he says, I didn't have to call somebody. Walmart called me up and said, what do you need? And I think that that is the key component of this partnership, that we're not working in silos. We have a common mission, and that we can communicate effectively.
Thank you very, very much. Any additional questions or comments? I'd only say that back in 2007, General Caldwell probably wished that I didn't have his phone number. So thank you. I certainly appreciate all of your input here and your coordination, and thank you for bringing to light the importance of the private sector and doing the critical kind of planning in advance that's so terribly critically necessary when we're hit with an emergency. And those of us who've been through it, it really makes a difference. Appreciate your all of your good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next I would like to call up, please, Mark Sansusi, and we're going to be talking, or he is going to be talking at least, about licensing of military spouses. Welcome back to our committee, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee. My name is Mark Sansusi. I'm the Defense Department's Regional Liaison for the Northwest. I'm here this morning to talk about military spouse professional licensing. First, I'd like to thank you for, oh, I realize it's me and then the dog, so I can't take too much time here. I'd like to thank you first for your support and your help in seeing through this past session, HB 4063, that gave the veterans academic and occupational licensing credit for their military service. I'd like to thank you for seeing that one through. This issue is the number two issue. This is our next big thing in terms of being the number two issue of our 10 in trying to help military families. In this case, it's professional license help for military spouses who move to Oregon as part of the military family. This issue has administration support. It's one of the joining forces key initiatives you may have seen in media, the Michelle Obama, Joe Biden joining forces initiative. As with many transient and mobile careers today, most decisions to stay in the military are made around the kitchen table, not in the personnel office. To retain our trained and experienced military, we must retain the family, even in an environment with downsizing, and as we adjust to ever-changing national security strategies. The Defense Manpower Data Center last year reported in a survey of active duty service members that 59% of our military are married. That percentage increases to 72% for non-commissioned officers and 73% for officers. As you know, NCOs and officers possess the critical experience necessary for our professional armed forces. And depending on the surveys, a couple of them that I would cite, between 70 and 85% of their spouses say they want to work or need to work. We know from the Defense Management Data Center numbers that the annual population of military spouses that moves across state lines is 14.5% compared to 1.1% for civilian spouses. Now, I know General Caldwell's a general, and I was just the colonel, but I heard him talk about active duty presence in Oregon, and Oregon, as of last year's data, does have 988 active duty spouses and 5,454 reserve military spouses. And the active duty ones do still tend to move every two or three or four years into and out of the state. Our data shows that around 53% of them are employed. So if we took the numbers just for Oregon, it would make 3,424 military spouses working in Oregon. We know that 34% of them, up to 34% of them, are licensed occupations. So if you only count the active duty spouses, I mentioned 988, half of them are working and a third of them have licenses, that's almost 200 people a year. Active duty military spouses that would benefit from policy change to help with their licensing. And it would be up to 580 if we included the active guard and reserve as far as military spouses with licenses. Like all those families today, and all families today, they depend on the two incomes to achieve their goals and aspirations and to succeed as a family. Clearly, military families today face challenges unique to their mobile lifestyle. We believe that they should not have to sacrifice their goals and dreams as well. The proposed policy consideration in what I hope we hope is a bill before you folks here in this coming year will help level the playing field for our military spouses so they can meet their families' financial needs and continue their careers. Over the last 3 years, since we've been working on this issue, 23 states have modified their policies to offer licensing help, and what we're talking about is temporary licensure if a spouse has an active license in another state and moves to this one, and there may be gaps between Oregon's requirements and, say, Kansas requirements. That spouse expeditiously gets a temporary license to go to work sooner rather than later. Licensed by endorsement, which is an acceptance of a regulatory body of the active credentials to recognize the active credentials from another state and allows for some options if there are some gaps in licensure. And, of course, trying to do it expeditiously to do these processes again so we can get those spouses into those jobs sooner rather than later. Anticipating a question, the Department of Labor has data on the top 10 military spouse, the occupations that military spouses tend to go into, and I'll just read them to you, and I can give this to Chana for your help. Registered nurse, pharmacy technician, medical assistant, medical billing, K through 12 school teachers, health administration and management, medical transcriptionist, dental hygienists or assistants, accountants, bookkeepers, auditors, and veterinary technicians. Of course, we don't want to just limit it to those 10, but I thought you might want to hear what the top 10 tend to be. In closing, we're grateful for the tremendous effort that Oregon has historically provided in supporting our service members and their families, including that veterans academic and occupational credit bill you folks were champions on for us and pushed through last year. We really appreciate that. I do know, and I can't speak for the general, but I do know we have Oregon Military Department support on this effort, and thank you for taking this up in the interim, and I stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Sanssouci? Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question. Thank you, Mark, for all you do. I see him all over the place at meetings, conferences, and he is just a wizard, I have to say, and very responsive. He had to send me the same email a couple of times because I have over 800 in my box now, so I had to really scroll back to find it. But he has sent forth some requests for legislation, and I would like to request that we do this as a committee bill instead of just individuals doing it, because I think it carries a little more weight. And what he suggests, I think, is very appropriate for what we can do here. So,
thank you very much.
Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Witt. I have some thoughts, though. When you're talking about different states for different criteria, how do you know that someone that's transferred in with a license from, I don't know, Utah, Alabama, South Carolina, doesn't matter, New York, has the same criteria we have in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Co-Chair and Committee,
and the knowledge of that.
Thank you for that question. I've heard that in other places, and we did get this passed in Washington State last year and did get it in Alaska 2 years ago, and again, 23 states have done this. The tendency is for states to always think that they have the best and tightest and toughest requirements. And
well, I know better than that.
Oh, okay. Well, there's a tendency I've heard there where somebody from another state tends to be inferior from our state. I don't know. That could be true here. I don't know. But I do know that the regulatory people, the boards and agencies, are able to look at the credentials and the requirements of Kansas or another state that the person comes from and is able to make a comparison there as to whether there's comparability or not. And then hopefully they are the spouse who comes here is issued, whether it's a temporary or by endorsement acceptance, the license to practice while fulfilling any of those gaps, small or large. That's the expectation. That's the hope. And again, with 23 states doing it, we're getting feedback so far that it's working out. We're not yet seeing any tremendous obstacles. But I think the burden is then on the regulators to learn where the state that person comes from, usually in associations and other things. They're able to know what the requirements are that state has that maybe your state has beyond.
Please.
Okay, Mark, then if there was some big discrepancy, our boards would say, whoa, time out here. But I'm sure you're going to find out that what we do in Oregon, they do in Kansas. They do in Alabama, they do in New York, but the thing that we're going to have to do is let our people know that's our intent, because they can make up all kinds of issues, and so therefore we have to, as legislators, ensure that it gets done.
And Mr. Co-Chair, yes, sir, and I just I'm giving you back what I've heard as pushback. One of the occupations that tends to be concerned is the nursing field, because if someone's a registered nurse from an inferior state and comes here and starts laying their hands on our patients and here in our state, we can't possibly have that inferior person practicing nursing. So I've heard that one, and again, our intent is to help our military spouses, and we let the regulators decide if in fact it's safe and healthy for their people. So we're not here to kind of impose or prescribe anything. Right. We'll let the state regulatory agency determine whether or not these other folks are acceptable.
So I'm raising a red flag here. We're going to have to, as legislators, and I fully support this.
Well, Co-Chair Esquivel, we got past similar concerns on House Bill 4063, and this committee is going to get past these concerns again when we become the 24th state to help spouses. Representative Parrish.
And I'd like to agree with Rep. Boone. You know, I think this is a great committee bill. I think most of us probably on board. I don't speak for anyone, but just a personal experience. We got moved from Southern Oregon to Georgia for the National Guard. And I went from being a contract auditor making a really good wage to waiting tables for $2.30 an hour, in some restaurant in Georgia, and then said, well, this is just ridiculous. So, because they are a no minimum wage tip type state for waiting tables. So to go from making, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month, whatever it was, to making $2.33 an hour in Georgia, it was not very pleasant in our world. So I am very supportive of this concept to be able to come in and have people move in and out of states, even if it's a small amount. We're doing the right thing. So,
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Parrish, Illinois has passed this bill. Georgia has not so far.
There you go.
So we're still working on it.
My husband's retired. I'm not moving anywhere again.
Let me know. I know a couple of those good old boys in Georgia. Let me know if you need some help.
I'd be calling on you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mark, you mentioned at the beginning of your testimony the fact that we were able to pass House Bill 4063. And I just, back at you, want you to know how much we appreciate all the background, the research, the best practices, the model language. And last but not least, when it came time for us to be able to define the parameters of, you know, get our arms around who's in, who's out, your help on that bill was just outstanding, and I want to thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And this is my full-time day job. The only thing I focus on, whereas you guys have millions of other things going on, so it's my pleasure.
Well, we will look forward to your assistance with as Representative Boone has already mentioned, and so has Representative Parrish, a committee bill dealing with spouses.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call up Joy St. Peter and Brandy Branzel with the Joy of Living Assistance Dogs for Veterans.
And look at those humble ears.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make sure that we waive the right of the dogs of having to say their names on the record.
Oh, look at the poodle.
Very well taken, Mr. Co-Chair.
The dog and not the breed. Think about the tail.
Although probably if some of them could do it.
I think I heard some comments from them in the gallery of just discontent with how long this thing's going on. So. Welcome. Good morning.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel, flanked by dogs.
Yes.
And we want to take it up a notch for the veterans. On my left is retired Major Brandy Branzel, and Joy St. Peter on my right, the founder of Joys of Living Assistance Dogs. And I want to recognize Robert, who is actually training his own service dog, a veteran. So we're excited to watch him work with his dog. He's been highlighted on Coin News 6 as well for his achievement. So we're excited. Sorry for the wiggly dogs. This is an outing for them today, and we've got one in service. The others are still in training. So I want to have Joy talk about the program, and then have the Major talk about her experience and what her dog has done for her, and then really just take questions. So with that, I'll have Joy lead off.
Thank you, Lori.
Co-chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. For the record, I'm Joy St. Peter, the founding director of the Joys of Living Assistance Dogs, and it's our mission at the Joys of Living to train and place dogs that create greater freedom and independence that we often take for granted. And we begin our puppy training at the very beginning, and it takes about 18 to 24 months to take a dog from the very beginning to the very end. Right now we have it's a four-year waiting list. It takes 2 years to train a dog. We have a four-year waiting list for a dog due to the amount of veterans that are coming back, and also due to the amount of puppy raisers that we have. And it's the amount of puppy raisers that kind of bottleneck this, and because we can't put any more dogs out than we have puppy raisers. And we do raise our dogs according to the ADI, which is the Assistance Dogs International Standards. The ADI is recognized by the federal VA that they will fund dogs for veterans if they get them from an ADI-accredited service dog organization. We're waiting for our audit, and we will be fully accredited ADI service dog organization, the first one in the state of Oregon. We've recently started our Help for Heroes program, which is veterans training dogs for veterans, and it's been very nice with the support and help of the Oregon chapter of the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. They've been very instrumental and supportive in what we do. So we want to recognize their help in what we do in helping our program grow. And this is a really unique situation that we face, and I totally understand where the veterans are coming from, and I do want to just kind of take a side note. My son is graduating from Airborne Friday, and then he will be going on from Fort Benning, and he will be going on to Special Forces Selection. So I have a special interest in my heart for this,
and I'm very excited for him as well. What I come to ask is for the help from the committee. What has happened is last week the VA has ruled that they will no longer fund dogs for PTSD, mental trauma, or physical emotional support dogs. And personally, I think that's very preposterous. Sorry for the mispronunciation of that word. But they're saying that there's not enough evidence supporting the fact that these dogs really do make a difference. And what I would like to do is start up a pilot program here in Oregon to get veterans and maybe start with 5 veterans and do a pilot program and give them that evidence that they're looking for, because there is plenty of evidence out there, but they're saying that there's just not enough. Well, let's give them what they need so that there is enough, because what these dogs offer these veterans, it does get them back on the public bus system so they can use those things. It helps them get out back into the community in ways that people like myself that have never served can never understand, but it's our way to say thank you for what they have given. So with that pilot program going, that we can take possibly 5 veterans that have some PTSD or traumatic brain injury and have them train some puppies for a disabled veteran as well. And by training a puppy, then they get the experience and they get the help that they need, and then they pass it on to their disabled comrade. And so it's a real win-win, and then they can also share that as well. The other thing that I would like to ask is for the Oregon to be the leading promoter of accepting this and hopefully changing the federal VA's viewpoint on accepting assistance dogs for our veterans for the brain, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and those types of issues. I have drafted up a memorial to kind of outline this, of what it is that I'm looking for and to help go forward with this. The thing is if we do go forward to this study, it costs us $15,000 to raise a dog from beginning to end. And so if we started with 5 dogs, that would be about $75,000. And we are totally nonprofit, and most of our volunteer, everybody, including me, are all volunteers in our organization. So there is nothing that is spent on extra funding, because it all goes to the dogs, and I'm happy to say that. As I would like you to also, I'm asking to help go back and talk to other states as well, and I'm not the only one that is supporting this and asking for this. The service dog industry is working very hard at helping out our veterans, doing what we can. We're working on partnering with the Wounded Warriors program as well and working with them, and so we're growing quite rapidly, but with the new ruling of the VA and not accepting post-traumatic stress disorder, brain injuries, and those types of things as a valid reason for having an assistance dog, that's making it extremely tough and for the people that really need it. Thank you for listening, and open for questions at the end.
Good afternoon. Good morning, gentlemen and ladies. I thank the honorable panel for inviting us here today. My name is Medina Brandy Branzell, field grade, major, retired. I'm here today to share with you what a service dog has made such a difference, how it has made such a difference in my life. I am 100% service-connected soldier. That was awarded by the Veterans Administration as a rating of my disability. It is service-connected, I reiterate. This dog, I am severely hearing impaired. He hears for me. He hears sounds I cannot hear. He focuses on the direction. He will nudge my shoulder. If I'm driving, he'll come up and place his shoulder here, or he will nudge my leg and point in the, not physically, just his head, where that sound is coming from. I am working with him to identify particular sounds. I cannot hear sirens when I am in a vehicle. And when he alerts, he stands up and literally turns in the direction. I've lost my stereo. I'm just mono now. He not only does that, he picks things up off the floor for me because I can no longer bend down well and get back up. He will brace and help me get back up if I go down, if I fall. I have balance issues. I am also a victim of military sexual trauma and suffer from PTSD. He will wake me when I'm screaming in my sleep. This dog has not been trained to do that. We are that closely bonded. I will have had him 1 year, October 19th, which is the next graduation for the service dogs. Please attend. In addition to that, he will take off my shoes. He will take off my socks. He will remove my clothing, but he is a male, so he must do that with my permission. So, and I too volunteer for this organization, but this animal, my companion, my life, he has my point, he has my clock, gentlemen. Right now, he has my six. I touch him, he senses I'm upset or I'm starting to get anxious. He just places his head on my lap or leans just a little bit and goes, I'm right here. It's all good. It's all good. I'm open for questions as Joy. Thank you very much.
And Lori, again, for the record, sentence bill. I've got some draft legislation in the memorial that I forgot to hand out in case you're interested in a placeholder or something that we might move forward with if the committee is even interested. We're also speaking to the Senate as well on the same issue tomorrow.
Thank you very, very much.
Good luck in the Senate.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so we kind of quantify what the ask is, if you were to walk out of the building at the end of the 2013 session, what you would like, I think you've identified, is the joint memorial, trying to encourage federal VA to, again, be more supportive of the support dogs. And then also, I heard a possible financial ask
for
training.
Yes, for a private program, yeah.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say congratulations to your son. As a former paratrooper, that's a big deal to graduate from Fort Benning, so good for him. Good for him, airborne all the way. and then some. And Major, thank you for sharing your story.
You're
We've said it before in this committee. It takes a tremendous amount of courage for folks to share their experience and others learn from it. And thanks for your leadership on that. I will say that I would support what you're asking for. I think that it's really hard to measure the effectiveness of an animal in terms of service animals. I've got an English bulldog that does nothing for me but make me feel pretty good.
We can help with
headache. You point me to a trainer, let's get that done. But I think it's very important. I think that you're right. We have to provide some evidence that says they're having an impact and making a difference. And as we see from our veteran here, who's training his own dog, that's just a big step. So very supportive and really appreciate being here. And want to commend and compliment the handlers and the animals for sitting through this entire committee. I sit in caucus quite a bit, and I couldn't do that for this kind of time frame. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Boone.
Thank you. I'm being the noisy one today. Sorry. I, too, support this wholeheartedly. And I think you might find, I don't know if they would accept it, but there is empirical evidence of and proof of positive results of animals working with prisoners, people with mental illness, all kinds of different areas that they're definitely having, and even cats. I mean, I'm sorry, dogs, but even cats. And I think that they're great. I'm a dog person, too. I don't have one right now, but I'm getting ready to get one again. And I just would, you know, I would say that if we could do this as a committee bill, if everybody would agree, and that would, but if not, I'm willing to sponsor something. But our deadline is Monday, I think, the 17th.
Well, just for pre-session stuff.
For pre-session, but that doesn't mean we couldn't do it later, too. So,
according to the VA ruling, it's Imperial Medical Evidence. I mean, that was real specific as to what they're targeting. So we could, you know, start charting that they're not taking as many meds and go into the medical end of it, because that's the part that they say that they're arguing.
But remember, your brain is still part of your body.
Yes.
Still connected.
And if I could add just quickly on to that, Joy is also working with a minimum security prison exactly on puppy raising and taking that into the prison system right now, is trying to find puppy raisers. If we could have everybody in the room a puppy raiser, you would be amazed how many more dogs this organization could put out.
And I know, I think Major wanted to jump in here with a comment.
Yes, sir. There's a 2-year waiting list for almost every service dog organization.
Wow.
For any individual. It is generally a minimum of 18 months to 2 years, every day, 24/7, from the day they're born to the day they graduate. As far as the VA and empirical medical evidence, I find that rather ironic. The VA currently has a program for service dogs, where they, if a veteran has a certified ADI service dog, they will pay for veterinary and emergent care. Pardon me. The VA considers these canines a prosthetic device, and they are. They are. And even a prosthetic could be a mental crutch. There's a way, if there's a will. So the evidence, even in the VA, is already there. I have been the first recipient from this organization, I'm very proud to say. This dog sells itself. It educates. It brings about smiles. It makes people feel this is Diego. He is great.
Representative Parrish.
Quick question on the puppy raising piece. So if it takes a couple years to get a dog fully up moving and be able to pass that to somebody, who's covering the expense of this? Is that the volunteer who is raising that puppy, and who covers the vet bills? And when you talk about, then the second question is when you talk about medical evidence that you need, in your pilot scenario, is there a doctor that you guys will be working with to track outcomes so that you are able to generate medical evidence?
What I'd like to do is partner with a VA hospital or a VA doctor. Okay. So it's their doctor. As far as the volunteers, they cover the the basic needs. I'm trying not to cough here. I'm really sorry. And so that part is tax deductible for them because they pay for the basics. If it's anything above the basics, the organization picks that up.
Okay.
As if there's weight bearing or balance and support, we have to have them x-rayed and make sure that their structure is structurally sound to have that weight bearing on them, and that takes x-rays and clearances so that we don't injure the dog in the process. And then if the dog, even though it fits, if it's not structurally sound for weight bearing or balance, then that person doesn't get that dog because it's not a good fit, because that dog cannot deliver the services that that veteran would need. And so it's those expenses, the and the equipment and all of the other things that come with it.
But basic vet care and food and toys and
yes.
whatever else they showers and flea medicine and stuff is on the person. I mean, I've got a dog, and I what I spend a year on my dog, and it's not cheap.
Right, but since we are a 501c3, they get to write those expenses off on their taxes okay. as a donation. So, thank you.
Very good. Representative Matthews.
Just a real quick, for our viewing audience at home, which I know there's thousands and thousands, we're pretty big in the South.
You are.
JoyDogs.com, the website, has a lot of the information that we're talking about here. So if anybody was curious into researching it, they could certainly find out what would be expected if they were to be one of the trainers. But also, some of the overwhelming things that people just kind of bog down and say, well, I can't do it because we travel every year. You actually take care of that, too, at 10 days' notice. So there's a lot of things that they can do in terms of boarding the pets and answering those questions just by the website. So thanks again for all being here. Really appreciate it.
And all the fun training is on the Facebook page. That's where all the fun stuff is.
So like them on Facebook. There we yes. go. We just covered the infomercial.
I'm wondering if there's something that we could do. It's going to take us a little time before we could pass any kind of legislation if the committee's inclined to entertain that. I suspect we all are, but we'll see in a minute. But I'm wondering if there was a sense of the committee that we wanted to perhaps, as a committee, send a letter to the VA with copies to our entire congressional delegation, whether you thought that would be helpful, and I'm seeing nods in the affirmative, and whether you all would be willing to work with Chiana here to get that drafted up. Would that would that work? And is that something that the committee members are interested in doing?
Friday? Is everybody here?
Yeah, if we could get that by Friday, we're all here, so it would make life very easy.
Everyone okay with that?
Maybe not for Chiana, but for very good. And Lori, I'm always intrigued by the personal pursuits of folks in the building here and whatnot, and this is probably something. It is something I didn't know that you were involved in. What's your level of involvement? Just curious.
Well, Chair.
Airborne?
That was yesterday on my 23-hour marathon getting back to Oregon. My daughter, my youngest, is now in college, mm-hmm. and when she became a freshman, she wanted to do something different. And I said, well, what should we do? Joy had an ad in the newspaper for puppy raisers, so we went down and went through the screening, and Joy had never had someone as young as my daughter. And so we both needed to make the commitment to puppy raise. And I told my daughter, I said, Morgan, now this dog doesn't just get to stay with us. So we went through that, and those are some of the questions we always get. Oh, how can you give that dog up? And I said, it's not my dog. This is community work. And so we took it on, and we started with some of these wiggly puppies. And as the daughter went off to college, I've moved sort of into, we need to have more exposure for the organization and try to garner whatever resources we can, because like I said, we're all volunteers. So if every one of you had a puppy to raise, you would be amazed at how many extra dogs we could put into the system.
Second time she said that. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Committee dog and passing.
We have a couple of minutes here. Does anyone want to introduce for the folks on television, particularly those down south, to see some of
we have television these, down south.
Some of the some of these service animals.
They get to be on parade.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would like to say one thing. I was always suspect of Representative Matthews, and now I find out he's airborne, and I just don't understand why you'd jump out of a perfectly good flying aircraft. I don't get that.
And if the handlers wanted to introduce themselves and their dogs, that would be wonderful, too. I think the recognition of the tremendous service that you provide for our veterans community is just so tremendous, and we'd like to know who you are and the names of your companions.
So cute.
I have my name is Gwen Welton, and I have Kirby, who's just he's one of our K litter, so he's brand new. So we have a very wiggly puppy.
Well, wonderful. Thank you very much.
He is a young one.
Kirby.
I'm former Master Sergeant Robert Ellisted, and JJ, sit. This is JJ.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Master Sergeant.
Thanks.
I'm just going to take up. I'm Karen Elliott, and this is Cody. He's also a very wiggly puppy, but he's being as good as he can.
My name is Stephanie Brigler, and this is Sergeant John, and he's actually in the program dedicated to one of our veterans coming back.
Thank you, Stephanie.
He'll be at the graduation. He's a graduating dog.
All right. Wonderful. Dogs.
I'm Pat Johnson, and I have a 10-month-old Jedi here. He's a little poodle, and he's hopefully going to go to somebody with PTSD.
Oh, well, wonderful. Well, it's not typically part of the decorum here, but I think a round of applause yeah. for the great work here.
There's Diego.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Does anybody but me notice that these dogs are all blonde? You know? They're beautiful.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Diego.
Diego.
Oh, oh, Diego.
Is a graduate.
What a good boy.
My dog. My buddy. The best of me.
Great.
The only man in my life. And the next time I marry will be February 31st.
Oh. He is so
young
cute.
Man. Well, not quite. He's still a teenager. Next month will be a young man. We are forever learning. And I'm the problem. Always. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, ma'am. Our canine friends stole the show today. Thank you all very, very much.
Were they Boy Scouts, like Service Project, Eagle Scout projects? Yes. Are they puppy raising?
We're working on that.
That is great.
Tremendous. Thank you all so very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to have a discussion now about possible committee legislation. And Chandler, if you'd just kind of kick this off for us, I'd be appreciative.
Sure will. For the records, Chandler Newell with Committee Services. I'll start with the most recent. It sounds like we may want to go ahead and do two committee bills relating to these dogs. One would be a joint memorial to the VA, and one would be a bill requesting a pilot service dog project. We also heard from Department of Defense about the military spouse license transfer. You're fairly familiar with that. Other requests that have come from the Department of Defense, one is a residency waiver for separating service members so that they can attend Oregon community colleges and universities at the resident tuition rate. Now, current law, as I understand...
I thought we did that.
Current law, as I understand, says that if you were an Oregon resident and you go elsewhere or you establish residency, you can come back immediately and get in-state tuition. But if you were a Georgia, since we've been picking on Georgia today, if you were a soldier in Georgia and you decided you wanted to come to Oregon when you separated,
it's not the 12-month way.
You would need to establish residency.
That's just a shortcoming we made in the law, obviously.
Yeah. This bill would change that and give tuition to any service member within 12 months of separating from the military.
Now, would this only for schools or would it be for other things as well?
I believe that this bill is specifically for schools. Mr. Sansusi is here and he can perhaps provide a little more elaboration.
Is there something else that would need license?
Well, I mean, if I moved here, I should be able to buy a resident hunting license, fishing license, things of that nature. You know, I mean, after all, what I do is for the United States of America.
That's right.
Mr. Co-Chair, this is intended for college tuition because the new the post 9/11 GI Bill, as of August of 2011, pays all the costs and all the tuition for a new veteran, but they pay the in-state tuition rates. So if someone moves back to moves to Oregon and wants to go to an Oregon University college, the post 9/11 GI Bill will pay the university, but the in-state rate And so the veteran is stuck with paying the difference. So if an out-of-state rate is three times the amount of an in-state rate, that veteran for the first year is going to have to pay that. And so we're looking for help in the states to waive the residency requirements so they're only having to be charged the in-state rate and not to have to make up that difference.
Just for the record, would
Paul, you want to come up?
Sorry, Mark Sansusi, Mr. Co-Chair. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Mark, does your draft legislation include then families that move here? Because, you know, just to be clear, post 9/11 GI Bill can be transferred to, you know, your child or your spouse. And if the husband moves here for a job post, you know, separation and wants to pass that, the wife and the child would still be in that same category if they're moving the whole family. So if we're going to do this, I want to make sure that we're including the family unit when they come and separate, if the spouse is going to use that post 9/11 GI Bill.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, I'm not sure the answer. I think the answer is no. You can do anything you want, but there are states. Well, Arizona
within reason.
With too many rules, you know.
The state of Arizona passed a really nice one here this year in 2012, and it's geared towards veteran. And I'm not sure about family. This is a brand new issue. The Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness is signing this one as one of our new issues this month, and so I'm still working on more data, but that's the intent. And also Idaho passed this in 2012 unbeknownst to me until recently, so sorry.
Chana, maybe some clarification.
Representative Parrish, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, to clarify, the way the statute is written in Oregon includes in the definition the dependents. So I think the way I have drafted this bill request would include the dependents.
Good. Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Escoval, members of the committee, my name for the record is still Paul Evans. At last notice, I haven't been run out yet, so it's still 744 Main Street East, Monmouth, Oregon, my address. This bill was actually, the reason I was jumping up and down in the back, this was actually one of those bills during the task force days that we presented to you in 09 that was a big issue because we actually had a discussion with the Chancellor of Higher Ed about a number of things that were going on at the time to kind of refresh our memories. We were trying to emphasize the absolute requirement that if you're a veteran, we don't care where you come from, but you're given, for our purposes, in-state residency. And the reason for that was to attract especially those that already have a bachelor's degree, but to actually help Oregon State, University of Oregon, and some of the master's and doctorate level programs that this could actually capture by making Oregon an attractive place to come and use those GI bills. So the community college, the way the statute was supposed to be written and supposed to be interpreted, the deal that we cut at the time was community college, Pendleton's haircutting institute, whatever it is, that's a legitimate expense for training for GI Bill, because again, it's not just education, it's also training activities, that in-state residency would be granted to any veteran, and we try to get their families in, so I'm glad that got in there, so that we could actually capture and realize what we believed was an opportunity to bring in those education dollars. So it's not one of those things where it was good for the veterans. It is. But it also, once we penciled it out, the Chancellor recognized after some discussions, and Joe Holliday, I think, was the guy's name that was working on it as well, that it was to all of our advantage to do that. So anything that we can do to move that forward. I thought that had been done. I know that some institutions have already been acting on that premise. It makes sense to be consistent.
Representative Parrish.
So can I clarify, Paul, that your thought is this is not just about when they separate and then move here. This is, we don't care how long they've separated. If they've got benefits, they want to use them here, we're going to call them resident right away. Is that what you're thinking? Is that how the bill is drafted?
Co-Chair Escoval, Representative Parrish, my perspective is because of all the other wraparound services that can come with a veteran going to school, even if it was a cost to the state, and I don't think it is, but even if it is for someone who's not a part of the new GI Bill, for example, somebody who's coming in and may not have access to old GI Bill or have used up all their GI Bill. They still may have opportunities because of other compensation packages, workers' comp, other things that may be a part of their family's package that is to our benefit to make Oregon open and available. So it's just bonus that it's that is the new GI Bill as well. At least that was our intent on the task force.
I'm Rhett Parrish, co-chair with members of the committee. The way it is written currently is just for veterans within 12 months of separation. So direction would be great to know.
Happy to waive the 12-month thing and just say if you land here, you land here.
And Paul, your recollection is that was not the initial or original intent.
Sir, if you had a DD Form 214, you were good. It didn't matter what day, because we recognized that it was a way to harvest dollars and opportunity to help the entire veteran community.
Well, and I think the sense is that, at least I'm feeling that we want to be inclusive in this regard, Representative Huffman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Did you say that community colleges had previously pretty much bought into this and they were on board?
Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Esquivel, Representative Huffman, not only bought into it, but actually saw the economic advantage of doing so.
I said community colleges, but...
Community colleges and universities.
And
both.
Okay.
We had a number of different meetings, different concerns. At the time, it was understood that there was somewhat of a relatively flexible perspective in terms of what institutions could or couldn't determine was in residency status. There was a lot of latitude. And... it was seen by everybody that it was to our advantage to make Oregon appear as open as possible, largely because we don't have a large active duty standing base structure. We have active duty guys, but not a base structure. So to compete and to be able to make sure we could especially reach out to a lot of the folks that we thought could help super energize the engineering specifically and some of the more complicated master's and graduate level programs by providing all the wraparound services, we thought it was a win-win for everybody. So the community colleges that were part of it.
And Mr. Co-Chair, broadening it is a great thing. I think the intent that we had, and seemingly a little more narrow, is that you had 1,296 people in 2011 move back to Oregon, retire or separate, and called as new veterans. As we know, with 1 million people getting out of the military between 2011 and 2016, that number for Oregon may increase. So our focus has been kind of towards the transition phase in the new veterans, but however you broaden it is fine with us.
Very good. If you'd pass the mic down, please. Oh, we have another one. Thank you. Welcome, sir.
Good morning. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Dave Cooley with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and thank you for letting me join this discussion. One of the programs that we have of benefits here in our state is the Oregon Educational Aid Program. This program is not a highly funded program. It's limited, and so we have to be very discerning about the number of people that are in the program so we don't run out of money. If we can commit to someone at the start of their education process, we want to stay with them for as many months of eligibility as they have. A veteran who's pursuing a part-time education of any kind is eligible for $100 a month for all the academic months that they are eligible for. They receive $150 a month for full-time pursuits. What I would want to bring to the attention of the committee is we don't have a 12-month residency requirement to administer this state benefit. We simply have a residency requirement. We don't have a six-month requirement. When someone moves to this state and establishes residency and can demonstrate that by an address, they are eligible for that education benefit. And the other part I'd like to share with you is that benefit does not have an expiration date. So on the front end, it says, we're glad you're here. And on the tail end, it says, this is a benefit that's available to you for the balance of your lifetime. So it's not a lot of money, but it is a commitment on our part to make sure that someone who wants to pursue education can do that and can do it right now. The only stipulation is they cannot draw federal veterans education benefits at the same time. So there is an example of something that we've committed to do as a state where we have not concerned ourselves with how long they've been here. The fact is they're here and they qualify. Thank you.
look forward.
Thank you very much. Committee members, it may make sense here to, since we're on this particular legislative concept, for us to consider whether we want to move this forward and have it drafted as a committee legislation. I'm not looking for a motion, but just kind of a consensus of the committee that we want to move forward. And I'm getting nods in the affirmative that we want to move forward with this, with the specific amendments that Representative Parrish wanted added with respect to spouses.
Independence, yeah.
And dependents. We kind of a thumbs up on this one. Okay, very good. Channel will work on that one. Yes,
one
Co-Chair
other thing
Esquivel.
We discussed, we had a had a, in our meeting, in our committee meeting, we discussed about, I believe, the VA home mortgage to parallel it with, make it parallel with the federal home mortgage. Haven't heard anything about that, so we need to find out where that's at, where it's going, because I think that's probably as important as anything that we can address and parallel that and make it even better than we have in the federal part of it. So does anyone know where we're at on that? Anyone? See, that Evans, he's all over this place.
Go with the feds. Yeah.
I know that that our agency, ODVA, again, thank you, Co-Chair, we are working on a package so that we can be an agency that can be in business and also write VA, federal VA loan guarantee mortgages.
No, that isn't it.
All right, then I'm missing it. Go ahead.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think what this question is related to is the short-lived duration of a bill that was before the special session related to refinancing of mortgages and giving the ODVA the authority to do that. And at the time, largely because of the shortness of the session, I believe, it was determined by leadership beyond that was not going to be a bill that was dealt
with. Complex.
However, what we said at the time, we can prove now, that the lack of having that capability has added to the homelessness program, or I should say the homelessness problems for veterans, and that the smartest thing the state can do is provide ODVA the tools to continue their home loan program, which right now, because of the just the economics of the situation and the age of a lot of those that are participating, we're losing capital out of that program, not because of anything that's done wrong, it's just that a lot of the mortgages are becoming complete, but allowing that capital to also be used for refinancing that will allow veterans' families to stay in their home, which then allows them to also probably keep their job and keep transportation and keep all the other elements that are necessary. And what is going on right now is it is an open market. A lot of people, I'm a veteran, not in great financial situations for a number of reasons right now. I get on average 7 to 12 letters a day or contacts via email or others about refinancing, all claiming veteran involvement. Because you're a veteran, you get out that none of them, by the way, are actually from the federal government. So the private sector recognizes, A, there's a profit opportunity there. So that's something to remember. Second thing is, keeping a vet and their family in their home helps prevent more problems over the long run. And number three, it actually would help the home loan program of Oregon be more effective because it would recapitalize that process. It's one of those things where it shouldn't cost the state much money. We have the federal authority and the federal dollars to be able to do that. It's just the state right now has not granted the ODVA the authority, legal authority, to do it.
Chair Esquivel.
I think that's a very, very important piece to our returning people. I think it's very, very sad that we cannot refi a home and with our ODVA, which is a better rate usually than the federal VA. And when I mean by mirrored, I mean we need to mirror it. But more importantly, this benefit should be an ongoing benefit. It shouldn't stop the first time you use it. And Example, if you use it in 1970, you borrowed $10,000, well, you're done with it. Whereas the federal VA, if you borrowed $10,000 in 1970, it continues on until they get today's criteria, say it's $420,000 or whatever it is, then they deduct the $10,000 off of it, and that's what you're eligible for. That's what we should be doing in the state of Oregon as well.
If I may, co-chair and committee, I sit right next to the underwriter, and we're a pretty small section up there, and so everyone hears everyone else's conversations. And if I could emphasize the number of phone calls alone that our agency takes, where the underwriter explains, first question is, if you're in your home for refinancing, how long have you owned it? And if they've owned it more than 18 months, then these rules apply, and we can't work with them. And so on the refinance piece that we cannot do, we are selling the federal VA refinance packages that Paul has said that the private sector is offering. And I know we have several veterans here in this committee, and I get those all the time, Paul. I got some more yesterday when I got home last night and opened my mailbox. Is the private sector they're going after this market. But the heartbreak for me and for our agency is when, for example, our underwriter has to tell someone, I'm sorry, we can't do that for you. And they're saying, if I could just refi, I could get there from here. And so he's encouraging them to do all the things that are possible. He also talks to people who are in distress over mortgages and the mortgage foreclosure process. So we provide a tremendous service. But when it comes down to actually being able to conduct that piece of business, we're not able to do that.
Commissioner Escobar?
I just want to clarify what I heard from you. You said if you were in the house for over 18 months, you couldn't help them?
On the refinance.
On the refinance piece.
On the refinance.
That's what the,
why would that matter?
The federal government, that's the standard they set for what is a refinance versus what is an original financing. Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, just one last thing, and then I promise I'll be quiet as long as I can. Government and the private sector both have different roles. I'm not suggesting the government should take over the private sector. What I am saying, though, is that with the unique problems that we are anticipating and actually seeing with this particular veteran cohort coming through and past veteran cohorts, the ability to do what ODVA does with home financing right now in terms of work with the homeowner to keep them in the home because the profit isn't the primary motive cannot be overemphasized in terms of as these vets coming back try to avoid bankruptcy, try to avoid they're trying to play by the rules and do the right thing because they're generally the folks that do that. That's why they joined in the first place. And if they can keep that home and if they can keep the family together, it is a significant savings, not just in economic terms, but also in social costs. And to me, it's one of those things where this isn't something that's very hard to do to have a huge dividend at the end. It will take some leadership because there will be some people in this building that are paid a lot and wear fancy suits trying to tell you, well, that shouldn't be something that ODVA does. I'm telling you, it's one of those things that can make a difference on keeping families together. It's one of those things that can make a difference in keeping somebody maybe not turning to the bottle or not turning to other types of circumstances. This is one of those things that a small bill can have a huge impact.
If I may, can I add on that, Co-Chair? We manage all of those loans. We portfolio every loan that we write, and we don't sell it to anybody else. So when a veteran's family gets in trouble, anyone gets in trouble, we get to work with that veteran directly on where are you at right now. So this is not that late night phone call at 10 o'clock where someone's trying to catch you because you're behind and you need to satisfy a bill. This is an agency that steps right to the front when a veteran is in trouble and says, how can we help you through this time with your mortgage? And I can't speak to those numbers, sir. I know if Tom Mann were here, perhaps he could. But I think that information was prepared previously about in numbers and families and percentages of how many foreclosures we didn't have compared to the national markets because we manage that in our portfolio in-house. Thank you.
I'm wondering if the committee might be interested in a future presentation the next time perhaps that we meet on this issue, and specifically I would like to have information on whether we have the money available to be able to offer refis and to make it a lifetime benefit, as co-chair Esquivel has suggested. And I recognize, I think, how our committee feels here right now, but it would not be the first time that I've had to temper how I personally feel relative to where our budget may be. But I'd like to have that presentation and have that information in front of us to see how far we might be able to go towards those ends.
Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's a bonding issue, isn't it? More than a budget.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Yeah, Co-Chairs, it's not general fund. It's other funds.
But it's our bonding authority, too.
Yes, sir, it is, but also some funds actually, I believe the figure now is $100 million. We used to have $25 million from the federal government to be able to do those things. So some are bonds, but some are actually pass-through funds from the feds to do that activity if the state allows it.
Very good.
So they don't affect the rest of the budget.
Doesn't affect the general fund.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes, Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, if I could just suggest that, you know, we've had some discussion already on what the VA does with foreclosures. That may not have been in this committee. That might have been in general government when we were going through foreclosure issues with the mortgage lending. But if we could maybe set a time as a committee to hear just not only about this issue, but also veterans homelessness. There's a number of efforts there.
Yes.
They're getting bogged down in background checks for some Section 8 housing. There's some big issues that I think we could really tackle and maybe you know, kind of mainstream some things. And I'd like to see us kind of do, you know, maybe we have a committee specifically related to veterans housing, and this could be one of those issues.
Representative Parrish?
Well, the other piece that I'd like to add to this, and forgive me if I missed it, but is the piece where we've got the loan program that you can, you know, the for initial loan, but once you tap that, you can't go back and use it again if you had a good mortgage. So even if you only used the loan and you had your house for 5 years, the mortgage was completely good and then you moved, right? I mean, it's, you can't ever tap that again. So, yeah, I'd like to see that happen.
That's kind of that lifetime benefit notion that Representative Esquivel was talking about. So kind of a consensus of the committee here, just kind of the whole veterans housing challenges and then possible solutions to those challenges would be a good subject matter here for perhaps our next meeting. All right. Shanna, can you handle that? Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much for your impromptu presentation. It's we value that very much. Thank you. Quickly here so that we can adjourn relatively timely. Military spouse licensure. We want to move forward with a committee bill on that matter as well. Anyone have any concerns there? Okay.
Not as far as a committee bill.
Fine. Two more here.
Committee bill, yeah.
The first, again, comes from the Department of Defense, and it would ask the state in its data gathering on K-12 children to include a universal identifier for children of military families who at least have one parent in the military, and that would allow the state to track their performance in school, days missed, achievements, graduation rates, etc. That's not information we gather right now, and it may help show long-term trends.
Representative Parrish.
So we talked about this in Ontario when we were out at the Military Child Education Coalition, and the folks boots on the ground absolutely felt that this is a challenge for them. They'd like to be able to reach into schools and lend support, whether it's with counseling for kids or some of the resources that are available, but they just don't know who these kids are. And so we heard from that entire community. All the community partners, you know, they were trying to figure out in their own end, could they work with the school district and, you know, add something to like the back to school, you know, checklist stuff. And, you know, and it felt really haphazard that would be a way that we would track data. We know that there are about 11,000 kids in Oregon, I think, that are somehow connected to the military. We just don't really know who all those kids are and how to find them and privacy laws and, you know, HIPAA and all this other type of stuff for the healthcare side, that if there was a way we could, you know, on, as kids are enrolling, have a box that they check. It's not, this isn't like, you know, a big crazy form. It's just, you know, do you, you know, are you connected somehow? And that's part of the enrollment package, I think, is, I don't know what the actual bill says, but that's one of the concerns that came out of that Ontario MSEC meeting. So.
Question?
Yes, Coach.
What, who's going to house the information and then who are we going to distribute it to? I guess that's
I haven't read the bill. I'm just saying what the challenge is.
Because I haven't read the bill.
I have not established that. This is just the request. So we don't have the bill yet. That's I'll see you'll find the right person.
Or how other states, I don't know other states are doing it.
Okay. Are these areas that we would want to move forward on and as a committee? I'm seeing nods in the affirmative. Any concerns? Okay. Chana, if you'll handle those two as well.
Will do. And last but not least is House Bill 2402, which was our 2011 bill to fund the Campus Veterans Service Program. As it currently sits, it is exactly the same bill. It would come from general fund dollars.
And we had a good deal of testimony on that in previous, I think, more than one hearing, as I recall, with general support for that. Do I have a sense of the committee that we want to move forward with that one?
No, I think it's worthy of discussion.
Okay, very good.
Do we have an amount on that?
An amount? I don't think we do.
Okay.
We had some figures that were presented to the committee at the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, Chana?
This is
please.
Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, in the 2011 session, it was estimated $1,100,000, so $1.1 million.
And that is general fund or was that
general
water?
Fund.
General.
It's general.
General fund.
Yeah. And then we had presented to us today draft legislation for a pilot program with the service dogs, and neither Co-Chair Esquivel nor I have had an opportunity to sit down together and meet with some of the departmental folks to see once again whether this is feasible in terms of our budget. I suspect that most of us would like to move forward here today. I would ask for your permission for the two of us to have those kinds of discussions, mm-hmm. and coming out of those discussions, we can report back to you and see if we would like to move forward at that point with some legislation. Representative Boone.
When you do that, could you maybe consider, while you're considering that, that this would be truly an act of prevention?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that really, try to figure out, I don't know if you could do it, how much money you would save, but it truly is worthy of upfront payment for something that would definitely have good results.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Parrish.
So I took a picture and I posted it out. Feedback from a nurse online. There are scientific studies that show animals, companions help lower blood pressure amongst other health benefits. So the folks who follow me are not happy that this program would not be supported.
And we have empirical analysis here, too. So, Coach Esquivel.
So that means we need more dogs in the building to keep our blood pressure down?
Yeah, we're gonna have to have
dogs back in the building.
We're going to have administrative services allow them in the building. So.
I'm not sure, though, that five is enough.
Well, if the six of us do a...
For a target group. Yeah. I'm not sure that's going to convince the VA.
If the six of us foster a puppy, then we get to bring six dogs to the building every day next session.
Oh, yeah, that'll
you're going to get Ramona walking through that door.
Exactly. She'll be boiling through there going,
yeah.
All right.
You.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are we going to move forward then with the concept and at least get it in the pipeline while you co-chairs are checking on
yes.
it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, and with that, I'd like to have Chana give us, you had some background announcements?
The one announcement I had was that the Vietnam Wall Memorial will be at the Skyline Memorial Gardens in Portland November 9th through 12th. And the ABA had some information on that, and they're looking for folks to volunteer and participate in that. And I can get you more information if you're interested.
Great.
That would be.
Do committee members have anything for the good of the order? Any announcements or anything? Yes, Representative.
Just that I'm working on furthering our effort with the kind of the no wrong door. Derek Bradley in my office is doing some great work, and we're trying to get ODVA or DMV, ODOT and whatnot on board with trying to do this at their level too, so that we can at least get our veterans in touch with ODVA so that they can kind of respond and find out what kind of benefits they have access to. So again, it's another effort, but it will never replace the need for the CVSOs. So we want to continue to push that out there. So that's what we're working on in my office right now. And as always, I'm happy not trying to get any credit for anything that we do. This committee does great work as a whole. So if the committee decides at some point you'd rather do committee bills, I think that gives us a greater authority and greater power and a little more, chance of passage. So
great.
I'm happy to offer it.
Agreed, and thank you, Representative Matthews, very much. Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yes, I want to emphasize to you two gentlemen out there that if we don't have room for a committee bill, be sure and contact us, because I'm sure a lot of us would be glad to talk about and sponsor a bill as per mortgages.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Representative Boone?
I just wanted to let you all know that on September 8th, although I was trying to get back into the state by air and driving, we had this veteran stand down in Clatsop County, and as usual, it's very popular, and there's always somebody who hasn't heard of these things, and this is where they have all the services available, including other services. And then one of the things that I always do is I hit Costco before I go and buy socks and T-shirts and undies and stuff like that that, everybody can pick. They have a big kind of grab bag of stuff. So it's a great way to reconnect in our community with our vets, and I tell people about it. I say, watch for the ads, watch for, they have a banner going in and out of town. And that sometimes, the guy who can't find a job, and he's literally supporting himself picking up cans and bottles, and I leave him bags at the recycle center, and he knows where to find them and stuff, or I leave them at the end of my driveway. And there are people living like that, and this is a way that they can get clothing, they can get services, they can get a haircut, they got screening for just the usual stuff, blood pressure and stuff. And you're absolutely right, when they have dogs, there a lot of veterans have dogs, that, and that keeps them calm.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's nothing further, I am going to thank very much all of the folks who testified today. I think this was a most informative committee hearing. I want to thank Shanna for putting together such a great agenda, and committee members, as always, your help and cooperation is great. This is a tremendous committee. This has been a great hearing, and we stand adjourned.
Okay.